But he had promised Rand to see Elaine safely to Camelin, and Nynaeve and Egwene with her. And he had promised Egwene to see the other two safe on this trip to Abu Dhar, not to mention Avienda. That was the price of getting Elaine to Camelin. Not that they had told him why they needed to be here. Oh, no. Not that they had spoken 20 words to him since arriving in the bloody city. "I'll see them safe," he muttered under his breath, "if I have to stuff them into barrels and haul them to Camelin in a cart." He might be the only man in the world who could say that about Aes Sedai without looking over his shoulder, maybe even including Rand and those fellows he was gathering. He touched the fox-head medallion, hanging under his shirt to make sure it was there, though he never took it off, even to bathe. It did have flaws, but a man liked to be reminded. "Taraben must be terrible now for a woman not used to taking care of herself," Julin murmured. He was watching three veiled men in tattered coats and baggy, once-white trousers scramble up the bank ahead of a pair of bookman's guards, waving their clubs. No rule said the poor could not come below the ropes, but the booker's guards did. The two pretty women who eyed Matt appeared to be making a private wager on whether the Tarabunners would outrun the guards. "We've more than enough women right here without sense to come in out of the rain," Matt told him. "Go back to that boat landing and wait for Tom. Tell him I need him as soon as possible. I want to know what those fool bloody women are up to." Julin's look did not quite call him a fool. They had, after all, been trying to find out exactly that for over a month now, ever since coming here. With a last glance at the fleeing men, he sauntered back the way he had come, once more bouncing the coin in his hand. Frowning, Matt peered across the race course. It was barely 50 paces to the crowd on the other side, and faces leaped out at him. A bent, white-haired old man with a hooked nose, a sharp-faced woman under a hat that seemed mostly plumes, a tall fellow who looked like a stork in green silk and gold braid, a nicely plump, full-mouthed young woman who appeared about to come out of her dress at the top. The longer the heat continued, the fewer and thinner garments women in Abu Dhar wore. But for once he hardly gave them any notice. Weeks had gone by since he so much as glimpsed the women who concerned him now. Brigida certainly needed no one to hold her hand. A hunter for the horn, anyone who troubled her would be in a deep hole by his estimation. And Avienda? All she needed was someone to keep her from stabbing everybody who looked at her crossways. As far as he was concerned, she could knife whoever she wanted, so long as it was not Elaine. For all the bloody daughter-heir walked about with her nose in the air, she turned moon-eyed around Rand, and for all Avienda behaved as if she would stab any man who glanced her way, she did the same. Rand usually knew how to deal with women, but he had jumped into a bear pit letting that pair come together. It was a short road to disaster, and why ruin had not happened was beyond Matt. For some reason, his eyes drifted back to the sharp-faced woman. She was pretty, if vulpine. About Nynaeve's age, he estimated. It was hard to tell at the distance, but he could judge women as well as he could horses. Of course, women could fool you faster than any horse. Slim? Why did she make him think of straw? What he could see of her hair beneath the plumed hat was dark. No matter. Brigida and Avienda could do without his shepherding, and normally he would have said the same of Elaine and Nynaeve, however wrong-headed, conceited, and downright pushy they could be. That they had been sneaking out all this time said differently, though. Wrong-headedness was the key. They were the sort who berated a man for meddling and chased him away, then berated him again for not being there when he was needed. Not that they would admit he was needed, even then, not them. Raise a hand to help, and you were interfering. Do nothing, and you were an untrustworthy wastrel. The fox-faced woman across the way popped into his view again. Not straw. A stable. Which made no more sense. He had had fine times in stables with many a young woman, and some not so young. But she wore modestly cut blue silk with a high neck right under her chin, trimmed in snowy lace, and more spilling over her hands. A lady. And he avoided noblewomen like death. Playing haughty like a harp, expecting a man always to be at their beck and call. Not Matt Cawthon. Strangely, she was fanning herself with a spray of white plumes. Where was her maid? A knife? Why should she make him think of a knife? And fire? Something burning, anyway. Shaking his head, he tried to focus on what was important. Other men's memories of battles and courts and lands vanished centuries ago filled holes in his own, places where his own life suddenly went thin or was not there at all. He could remember fleeing the two rivers with Moraine and Lan quite clearly, for example, but almost nothing more until reaching Camelin. And there were gaps before and after as well. If whole years of his own growing up lay beyond recall, why should he expect to recollect every woman he had met? Maybe she reminded him of some woman dead 1,000 years or more. The Light knew that happened often enough. Even Brigida sometimes tickled his memory. Well, there were 4 women here and now who had his brain tied in knots. They were what was important. Nynaeve and the others were avoiding him as if he had fleas. 5 times he had been to the palace, and the once they would see him, it was to say they were too busy for him, and send him away like an errand boy. It all added up to one thing. They thought he would interfere with whatever they were up to, and the only reason he would do that was if they were putting themselves in danger. They were not complete fools. Idiots, often, but not complete fools. If they saw danger, there was danger. Some places in this city, being a stranger or showing a coin could bring a knife in your ribs, and not even channeling would stop it if they did not see it in time. And here he was, with Nalesian and 12 good men from the band, not to mention Tom and Julin, who actually had rooms in the servants' quarters of the palace, all left to twiddle their thumbs. Those thick-skulled women were going to get their throats cut yet. "Not if I can help it," he growled. "What?" Nalesian said. "Look, they're lining up, Matt. The Light burn my soul, I hope you're right. That piebald doesn't look half-crazed to me. He looks eager." The horses were prancing, taking their places between tall poles stuck in the ground, with streamers tailing from the tops of them in a warm breeze, blue and green and every color, some striped. 500 paces down the track of hard-beaten red clay, an identical number of streamered poles made another row. Each rider had to round the same colored streamer as floated to his right at the start, and then return. A booker stood at either end of the line of horses, just to the front, a round woman and a rounder man, each with a wife's scarf held overhead. The bookers took turns at this, and were not allowed to accept wagers on a race they started.
"Burn me," Nalesian muttered.
"Light man, be easy. You'll tickle your seamstress under the chin yet." A roar drowned the last word as the scarves came down, and the horses surged forward, even the sound of their hooves submerged in the noise of the crowd. In 10 strides, Wind had the lead, Alver lying close on his neck, with the silver-maned Dun only a head back. The piebald trailed in the pack, where the rider's switches already rose and fell frantically.
"I told you the Dun was dangerous," Nalesian moaned. "We shouldn't have wagered everything."
Matt did not bother to answer. He had another purse in his pocket, and loose coins besides. He called the purse his seed. With that, with even a few of the coins in it, and a game of dice, he could repair his fortunes, whatever happened this morning. Halfway down the course, Wind still held the lead, the Dun clinging close a full length ahead of the next horse. The piebald was running 5th. After the turn would come the hazard. Boys on trailing animals were known to slash at those who rounded the stakes ahead of them. Following the horses, Matt's eyes swept across the sharp-faced woman again, and snapped back. The shouts and screams of the crowd faded. The woman was shaking her fan at the horses and jumping excitedly, but suddenly he saw her in pale green and a rich gray cloak, her hair caught in a frothy net of lace, skirts held up delicately as she picked her way across a stable not far from Camelin. Rand still lay there moaning in the straw, even if the fever seemed gone. At least he was not shouting any more at people who were not there. Matt eyed the woman suspiciously as she knelt beside Rand. Maybe she could help as she claimed, but Matt did not trust as he once had. What was a fine lady like this doing in a village stable? Caressing the ruby-tipped hilt of the dagger hidden by his coat, he wondered why he had ever trusted. It never paid. Never.
"Weak as a day-old kitten," she was saying as she reached beneath her cloak.
A knife appeared in her hand so suddenly, streaking for Matt's throat, that he would have been dead if he had not been ready. Dropping flat, he seized her wrist, just pushing it away from him, the curved Shadar Logoth blade sweeping out to lie against her slim white neck. The woman froze, trying to look down at the sharp edge dimpling her skin. He wanted to slice, especially when he saw where her own dagger had stabbed into the stable wall. Around the slim blade, a black circle of char grew, and a thin gray tendril of smoke rose from wood about to burst into flame. Shivering, Matt rubbed a hand across his eyes. Just carrying that Shadar Logoth knife had nearly killed him, eating those holes in his memories. But how could he forget a woman who tried to kill him? A dark friend, she had admitted as much, who tried to kill him with a dagger that set a bucket of water near boiling when they tossed it in after securing her in the tack room. A dark friend who had been hunting Rand and him. What chance she was in Ebu Dar when he was, at the races on the same day? Taviren might be the answer. He liked thinking of that about as much as he did the Horn of Bloody Valir. But the fact was, the Forsaken knew his name. That stable had not been the last time Dark Friends tried putting an end to Matt Cawthon. He staggered as Nalesian suddenly began pounding his back.
"Look at him, Matt! Light of heaven, look at him!"
The horses had rounded the far poles, and were well on their way back. Head stretched out, mane and tail flying behind, wind streaked down the course with Alvar clinging to his back like a part of the saddle. The boy rode as if he had been born there. 4 lengths behind, the piebald pounded furiously, rider working his switch in a futile effort to close. Just like that, they slashed across the finish line, with the next nearest horse another 3 lengths back. The white-maned Dunn came last. The moans and mutters of losing betters overwhelmed the shouts of winners. Losing tokens made a shower of white onto the track, and dozens of the booker's servants rushed out to clear them away before the next race.
"We have to find that woman, Matt. I'd not put it past her to run off without paying out so much as she owes us."
From what Matt had heard, the Booker's Guild was more than harsh the first time one of its members tried anything of the sort, and deadly the second. But they were commoners, and that was enough for Nalesian. "She's standing right over there in plain view," Matt gestured without taking his eyes from the fox-faced dark friend. Glaring at a token, she hurled it to the ground, and even lifted her skirts to stamp on it. Plainly not a wager on wind. Still grimacing, she began threading her way through the crowd. Matt stiffened. She was leaving.
"Gather our winnings, Nalesian, then take Alvar back to the inn. If he misses his reading lesson, you'll kiss the Dark One's sister before Mistress Anon lets him out for another race." "Where are you going?"
"I saw a woman who tried to kill me," Matt said over his shoulder.
"Give her a trinket next time," Nalesian shouted after him.
Following the woman was no trouble, what with that white-plumed hat for a banner bobbing through the crowd on the other side. The earthen banks gave way to a large open area, where brightly lacquered coaches and sedan chairs waited under the watchful eyes of drivers and bearers. Matt's horse Pips was one of scores being guarded by members of the ancient and worshipful Guild of Stablemen. There was a guild for most things in Ebu Dar, and woe to anyone who trespassed on their ground. He paused, but she walked on by the conveyances that had brought those with position or money. No maid, and now not even a chair. No one walked in this heat who had money to ride. Had Milady come on hard times? The Silver Circuit lay just south of the tall, white-plastered city wall, and she strolled up the 100 paces or so of road to the broad, pointed arch of the Muldine Gate and in. Trying to appear casual, Matt followed. The gateway was 10 spans of dim tunnel, but her hat stood out among the folk passing through. People who had to walk seldom wore plumes. She seemed to know where she was going on the other side. The plumes wove through the crowds ahead of him, unhurried, but always moving forward. Ebu Dar shone white in the morning sun, white palaces with white columns and screened wrought-iron balconies cheek by jowl, with white-plastered weaver's shops and fishmongers and stables. Great white houses with louvered shutters hiding their arched windows, beside white inns with painted signs hanging in front, and open markets under long roofs where live sheep and chickens, Calves and geese and ducks made a barnyard din alongside their fellows already butchered and hanging. All white, stone or plaster, except here and there bands of red or blue or gold, on turnip-shaped domes and pointed spires that had balconies running around them. There were squares everywhere, always with a statue larger than life on a pedestal or a splashing fountain that only emphasized the heat, always packed with people. Refugees filled the city, and merchants and traders of every sort. Never a trouble but brought profit to somebody. What Saldaya had once sent into Ara-Daman now came downriver to Abu Dhar, and so did what Amadisia had traded into Tarabun. Everyone scurried, for a coin or a thousand, for a bite to eat today. The aroma that hung in the air was equal parts perfume, dust, and sweat. Somehow, it all smelled desperate. Barge-filled canals sliced through the city, crossed by dozens of bridges, some so narrow that two people would have to squeeze past one another, others large enough that shops actually lined them, hanging out over the water. On one of those, he suddenly realized that the white-plumed hat had stopped. People flowed around him as he did, too. The shops here were really just open wooden nooks, with heavy plank shutters that could be let down to close them off at night. Raised overhead now, the shutters displayed signs for the shops. The one above the plumed hat showed a golden scale and hammer, sign of the goldsmith's guild, though plainly not of a particularly prosperous member. Through a momentary gap in the crowd, he saw her look back, and turned hurriedly to the narrow stall to his right. On the wall at the back hung finger rings and boards displaying stones cut in all sorts of designs.
"My lord wishes a new signet ring?"
the bird-like fellow behind the counter asked, bowing and dry-washing his hands. Skinny as a rail, he had no worry of anyone stealing his goods. Cramped into a corner on a stool sat a one-eyed fellow who might have had trouble standing upright inside the cubicle, with a long cudgel studded with nail heads propped between his massive knees.
"I can cut any design, as my lord can see, and I have tryings for size, of course."
"Let me see that one." Matt pointed at random. He needed some reason to stand here until she went on. It might be a good time to decide exactly what he was going to do.
"A fine example of the long style, my lord. Much in favor now. Gold, but I work in silver as well. Why, I think the size is right, if my lord will care to try it on. My lord may wish to examine the fine detail of the carving. Does my lord prefer gold or silver?"
With a grunt that he hoped might be taken for answer to some of that, Matt shoved the proffered ring onto the second finger of his left hand and pretended to examine the dark oval of carved stone. All he really saw was that it was as long as the joint of his finger. Head down, he studied the woman from the corner of his eye, the best he could through gaps that opened in the throng. She was holding a wide, flat gold necklace up to the light. There was a civil guard in Abu Dhar, but not a very efficient one, seldom to be seen on the streets. If he denounced her, it would be his word against hers, and even if he was believed, a few coins might let her walk free even on that charge. The civil guard was cheaper than a magistrate, but either could be bought unless someone powerful was watching, and then, if enough gold lay in the offer. A swirl in the crowd suddenly turned into a white cloak, conical helmet and long mail shirt gleaming like silver, snowy cloak with the flaring golden sun billowing as he strode along, confident that a path would clear for him. Which it certainly did. Few willingly put themselves in the way of the Children of the Light. Yet for every eye that slid away from the stone-faced man, another beamed on him approvingly. The sharp-faced woman not only looked at him openly, she smiled. A charge laid against her might or might not put her in prison, but it could be the spark to ignite a city full of tales about dark friends in the Tarasan Palace. White cloaks were good at whipping up mobs, and to them, Aes Sedai were dark friends. As the Child of the Light passed her, she laid down the necklace, apparently regretful, and turned to go.
"Does the style suit my lord?"
Matt gave a start. He had forgotten the skinny man and the ring, too. "No, I don't want—" Frowning, he tugged at the ring again. It would not budge.
No need to pull. You might crack the stone.
Now that he was no longer a potential customer, Matt was no longer my lord, either. Sniffing, the fellow kept a sharp eye on him, lest he try to run.
I have some grease. Darrell, where's that grease pot?
The guard blinked and scratched his head as if wondering what a grease pot was. The white-plumed hat was halfway to the end of the bridge already.
I'll take it, Matt snapped.
No time for haggling. Pulling up a fistful of coins from his coat pocket, he slapped them down on the counter, mostly gold and a little silver.
Enough?
The ringmaker's eyes bulged.
A little too much,
he quavered uncertainly. His hands hesitated above the coins, then two fingers pushed a pair of silver pennies toward Matt.
So much?
Give them to Darrell, Matt growled as the bloody ring slipped from his finger. The skinny man was hurriedly raking up the rest of the coins. Too late to try backing out of the purchase. Matt wondered by just how much he had overpaid. Stuffing the ring into his pocket, he hastened after the dark friend. The hat was nowhere to be seen. Twinned statues decorated the end of the bridge, pale marble women over a tall span, each with one breast bared and a hand raised to point toward something in the sky. In Ebu Dar, a bare chest symbolized openness and honesty. Ignoring stares, he climbed up beside one of the women, steadying himself with an arm around her waist. A street ran along the canal, and two more split off at angles ahead, all full of people and carts, sedan chairs and wagons and coaches. Someone shouted in a rough voice about real women being warmer, and a number in the crowd laughed. White plumes appeared from behind a blue lacquered coach on the left-hand fork. Leaping down, he pushed up the street after her, ignoring the curses of those he bumped. It was an odd chase. In the mass of people, with wagons and coaches constantly getting in his way, he could not keep a clear sight of the hat from the street. Scampering up the broad marble steps of a palace, he got another glimpse, then scurried back down to shove ahead. The rim of a tall fountain gave him yet another view, then an upended barrel against a wall, and a crate that had just been unloaded from an ox cart. Once he clung to the side of a wagon until the driver threatened him with her whip. With all the climbing and looking, he did not narrow the dark friend's lead very much. But then, he still had no notion what to do if he caught her. Suddenly, when he hoisted himself up onto the narrow coping along the face of one of the big houses, she was not there anymore. Frantically, he looked up and down the street. The white plumes no longer waved through the crowd. In easy sight were half a dozen houses, much like the one he was clinging to, several palaces of various sizes, two inns, three taverns, a cutler's shop with a knife and a pair of scissors on its sign, a fishmonger with a board painted in 50 kinds of fish, two rug weavers with unrolled carpets spread on tables beneath awnings, a tailor's shop, and four cloth sellers, two shops displaying lacquerware, a goldsmith, a silversmith, a livery stable. The list was too long. She could have gone into any of them, or none. She might have taken a turn he had not seen. Jumping down, he settled his hat, muttering under his breath, and saw her. Almost at the top of the wide stairs, leading to a palace nearly across from him, already half hidden by the tall fluted columns out front. The palace was not large, with only two slim spires and a single pear-shaped dome banded in red, but Ebu Dari palaces always gave the ground floor to servants and kitchens and the like. The better rooms were high, to catch the breezes. Doorman, liveried in black and yellow, bowed deeply and swung the carved doors wide before she reached them. A servant inside curtsied, apparently saying something, and immediately turned to lead her deeper. She was known. He would have wagered everything on it. For a while after the doors closed, he stood there studying the palace. Not the richest in the city by far, but only a noble would dare build its like. "But who in the pit of doom lives there?" he muttered finally, plucking off his hat to fan himself. Not her, not when she had to walk. A few questions in the taverns along the street would tell him, and word of his queries would seep to the palace, sure as dirt soiled your hands. Someone said, "Caradin." It was a scrawny, white-haired fellow, lounging nearby in the shade. Matt looked at him questioningly, and he grinned, showing gaps in his teeth. His stooped shoulders and sad, weathered face did not fit his fine gray coat. Despite a bit of lace at his neck, he was the very picture of hard times.
"You asked who lived there. The Chelsane Palace is let to Jakim Cardin."
Matt's hat paused. "You mean the White Cloak Ambassador?"
"Aye, and Inquisitor of the Hand of the Light."
The old man tapped a gnarled finger against the side of his beak of a nose. Both looked to have been broken several times.
"Not a man to bother unless you must, and then I'd think three times."
Unconsciously, Matt hummed a bit of Storm from the Mountains. Not a man to bother indeed. Questioners were the nastiest of the White Cloaks. A White Cloak Inquisitor who had a dark friend come to call. "Thank you." Matt gave a start. The fellow was gone, swallowed up in the crowd. Strange, but he had looked familiar. Maybe another long-dead acquaintance drifting out of those old memories. Maybe... It hit him like an illuminator's night flower exploding inside his head. A white-haired man with a hooked nose. That old man had been at the Silver Circuit, standing not far from the woman who had just gone into Cardin's rented palace. Turning his hat in his hands, he frowned uneasily at the palace. The mire never held a bog like this one. He could feel the dice tumbling in his head suddenly, and that was always a bad sign. Chapter 15 Insects. Cardin did not look up immediately from the letter he was writing when the Lady Cheyenne, as she called herself, was shown in. Three ants struggled futilely in the wet ink, trapped. Everything else might be dying, but ants and cockroaches and every sort of vermin seemed to thrive. Carefully, he pressed the blotter down. He was not about to begin again for a few ants. A failure to send this report, or a report of failure, might doom him as surely as those mired insects. Yet it was fear of a different failure that tightened his guts. He had no worry of Cheyenne reading what he wrote. It was in a cipher known only to two men beside himself. So many bands of dragon sworn at work, each stiffened by a corps of his most trusted men. So many more who might be bandits, or even truly sworn to that filth, Althor. Pedro Nile might not like that last, but his command had been to plunge Altara and Murundi into blood and chaos from which only Nile and the Children of the Light could rescue them. A madness clearly to be laid at the feet of this so-called dragon reborn, and that he had done. Fear held both countries by the throat. Tales that the witches marched across the same country were an added reward. Tarvalin witches and dragon-sworn, Aes Sedai carrying off young women and setting up false dragons, villages in flames and men nailed to the doors of their barns. It was all one in half the street rumors now. Nile would be pleased, and send more orders. How he expected Cardin to snatch Elaine Trakand out of the Tarasin Palace was beyond reason. Another ant skittered across the ivory inlaid table onto the page, and his thumb stabbed down, destroying it, and smearing a word to illegibility. The entire report would need to be redone. He wanted to drink very badly. There was brandy in a crystal flask on the table by the door, but he did not want the woman to see him drinking. Suppressing a sigh, he shoved the letter aside and pulled a kerchief from his sleeve to wipe his hand. "So, Cheyenne, do you finally have progress to report? Or have you just come for more money?" She smiled at him lazily from a tall carved armchair. "There are expenses associated with a search," she said in almost the accents of an Andoran noble. "Especially when we want no questions asked." Most people would have been unsettled by the sight of Jakim Cardin, even cleaning a pen-nib, with his steely face and deep-set eyes, the white tabard over his coat bearing the golden sunburst of the Children of the Light impressed upon the crimson shepherd's crook of the hand. Not Millie Skane. That was her real name, though she did not know he knew. A saddler's daughter from a village near Whitebridge, she had gone to the White Tower at 15, another thing she thought secret. It was hardly the best start, becoming a friend of the dark because the witches told her she could not learn to channel. But before that year was out, she had not only found a circle in Camelin, but made her first kill. In the 7 years since, she had added 19 more. She was one of the best assassins available, and a hunter who could find anyone or anything. That much he had been told when she was sent to him. A circle reported to her now. Several of them actually were nobles, and almost all were older. But neither thing mattered among those who served the Great Lord. Another circle working for Cardin was led by a gnarled beggar with one eye, no teeth, and a habit of bathing only once in the year. Had circumstances been different, Cardin himself would have knelt to old Cully, the only name the stinking villain admitted to. Millie Skane surely groveled for old Cully, and so did every last companion of her circle, noble or not. It irritated Caradin that Lady Cheyenne would be on her knees in a flash if the straggly-haired old beggar entered the room, but for him she sat with her legs crossed, smiling, and twitching her slippered foot, as if impatient to be done. She had been ordered to obey him absolutely by one even old Cully would grovel for, and besides, he had a desperate need of success. Niall's schemes could go to dust, but not this. "Many things can be excused," he said, laying the pen on its ivory stand and shoving back his chair, "for those who accomplish the tasks they are given." He was a tall man, and he loomed threateningly. He was well aware that the gilt-framed mirrors on the wall showed a figure of strength, a dangerous man. "Even dresses and baubles and gambling, paid for with coin that was to go for information." That twitching foot froze for an instant, then began again, but her smile was forced, her face pale. Her circle obeyed her instantly, but they would string her up by the heels and skin her alive if he spoke the word. "You have not accomplished very much, have you? In fact, you do not seem to have accomplished anything."
"There are difficulties, as you well know," she said breathily.
She managed to meet his eyes squarely, though.
"Excuses! Tell me of difficulties surmounted, not those you stumble over and fall. You can fall a long way if you fail in this."
Turning his back, he strode to the nearest window. He could fall a long way, too, and he did not want to risk her seeing anything in his eyes. Sunlight slanted through the ornate stone screen. The high-ceilinged room, with its green and white tiled floor and bright blue walls, stayed comparatively cool behind the thick walls of the palace, but the heat outside seeped in near the windows. He could almost feel the brandy across the room. He could not wait for her to be gone.
"My Lord Caradin, how can I have anyone ask too openly about objects of the power? That will cause questions. And there are Aes Sedai in the city, you will recall."
Peering down at the street through the scroll carvings, he wrinkled his nose at the smell. Every sort was jammed together down there. An Arafelon with his hair in two long braids and a curved sword on his back tossed a coin to a one-armed beggar, who scowled at the gift before tucking it under his rags and resuming his piteous cries to the passers-by. A fellow in a torn, bright red coat and even brighter yellow breeches came running from a shop clutching a bolt of cloth to his chest, pursued by a shouting, pale-haired woman who had her skirts pulled above her knees and was outpacing the burly guard who lumbered behind her waving his truncheon. The driver of a red lacquered coach with the moneylender's gold coins and open hand on the door shook his whip at the driver of a canvas-covered wagon whose team had become entangled with the coaches, the pair filling the street with curses. Grimy street urchins crouched behind a dilapidated cart while they snatched puny, shriveled fruit brought in from the country. A Tarabunner woman pushed her way through the crowd, veiled, her dark hair in thin braids, drawing every male eye in her dusty red dress that shaped itself to her form shamelessly.
"My lord, I must have time. I must. I cannot do the impossible, certainly not in days."
"Trash, all of them. Grubbers for gold and hunters for the horn. Thieves, refugees, even tinkers. Scum."
Riots would be easy to start, a purge for all this filth. Outlanders were always the first targets, always to blame for whatever was wrong, along with neighbors who had the misfortune to be on the wrong side of grudges, women who peddled herbs and cures, and folk with no friends, especially if they lived alone. Properly guided, as carefully as such things could be, a good riot might well burn the Tarasin Palace down around that useless jade Tylan and the witches as well. He glared at the swarm below. Riots did tend to get out of hand. The civil guard might stir itself, and inevitably a handful of true friends would be snapped up. He could not afford the chance that some of those might be from the circles he had hunting. For that matter, even a few days of rioting would disrupt their work. Tylan was not important enough for that. She did not matter at all, in truth. No, not yet. Niall he could afford to disappoint, but not his true master.
"My Lord Conradin,"
a note of defiance had entered Cheyenne's voice. He had let her stew too long.
"My Lord Conradin, some of my circle question why we are looking for—"
He started to turn, to put her down hard. He needed success, not excuses, not questions. But her voice dwindled to nothing as his eyes fell on a young man standing diagonally across the street, in a blue coat with enough red and gold embroidery on the sleeves and lapels for two nobles. Taller than most, he was fanning himself with a broad-brimmed black hat, and adjusting his neck scarf as he spoke to a stooped, white-haired man. Carden recognized the young man. Suddenly he felt as though a knotted rope had been fastened around his head, and was being drawn ever tighter. For an instant, a face hidden behind a red mask filled his vision. Night-dark eyes stared at him, and then were endless caverns of flame, and still staring. Within his head the world exploded in fire, cascading images that battered him and swept him beyond, screaming. The forms of three young men stood unsupported in air, and one of them began to glow, the form of the man in the street. Brighter and brighter, till it must have seared any living eyes to ash. Brighter still, burning. A curled golden horn sped toward him, its cry pulling his soul, then flashed into a ring of golden light, swallowing him, chilling him until the last fragment of him that recalled his name was sure his bones must splinter. A ruby-tipped dagger hurtled straight at him, curved blade striking in between the eyes and sinking in, until gold-wrapped hilt and all was gone. And he knew agony that washed away all thought that what had gone before was pain. He would have prayed to a creator he had long abandoned, if he remembered how. He would have shrieked, if he remembered how, if he remembered that humans shrieked, that he was human. On and on, more and more. Raising a hand to his forehead, he wondered why it trembled. His head ached, too. There had been something. He gave a start at the street below. Everything was changed in the blink of an eye, the people different, wagons moved, colorful coaches and chairs replaced by others. Worse, Cawthon was gone. He wanted to swallow that whole flask of brandy in one gulp. Suddenly he realized that Cheyenne had stopped talking. He turned, ready to continue putting her in her place. She was leaning forward in the act of rising, one hand on the arm of her chair, the other raised in a gesture. Her narrow face was fixed in petulant defiance, but not at Carradine. She did not move. She did not blink. He was not sure she breathed. He barely noticed her.
"Ruminating," Samael said. "Can I at least hope that it was about what you are here to find for me?"
He stood only a little taller than average, a muscular, solid man in a coat of the high-collared Ilioner style, so covered with gold work it was hard to tell the cloth was green. But more than being one of the chosen gave him stature. His blue eyes were colder than a winter's heart. A livid scar burned down his face from golden hairline to the edge of golden, square-cut beard, and it seemed a suitable decoration. Whatever got in his way was brushed aside, trampled, or obliterated. Carden knew Samael would have turned his bowels to water if the man had just been someone met by chance. Hurriedly moving from the window, he dropped to his knees before the Chosen. He despised the Tarvalan witches. Indeed, he despised anyone who used the One Power. Meddling with what had broken the world once, wielding what mere mortals should not touch. This man used the power, too. But the Chosen could not be called mere mortals. Perhaps not mortals at all. And if he served well, neither would he be.
Great Master, I saw Matt Cawthon.
Here? Oddly, for a moment, Samael seemed taken aback. He murmured something under his breath, and the blood drained from Cardin's face at one caught word.
Great Lord, you know I would never betray...
You, fool! You haven't the stomach!
Are you certain it was Cawthon you saw?
Yes, Great Master. In the street.
I know I can find him again.
Samael frowned down at him, stroking his beard, looking through and beyond Jacob Carradine. Carradine did not like feeling insignificant, especially when he knew it was true.
No, Samael said finally. Your search is the most important thing, the only thing, so far as you are concerned. Cawthon's death would be convenient, certainly, but not if it draws attention here. If it appears that attention is already here, should he take an interest in your search, then he dies, but otherwise he can wait.
But did you mishear me?
Samael's scar pulled his smile into a snarl on one side.
I saw your sister Venora recently. She did not look well at first. Screaming and weeping, twitching constantly and pulling at her hair. Women do suffer worse than men from the attentions of Murdral. But even Murdral must find their pleasures somewhere.
Don't worry that she suffered too long. The Trollocs are always hungry. The smile faded. His voice was stone.
Those who disobey can find themselves over a cook fire, too.
Venora seemed to be smiling, Carradin. Do you think you would smile, turning on a spit? Carradin swallowed in spite of himself and quelled a pang for Venora. With her ready laugh and her skill with horses, daring to gallop where others feared to walk. She had been his favorite sister, yet she was dead, and he was not. If there were any mercies in the world, she had not learned why.
I live to serve and obey, Great Master.
He did not believe he was a coward, but no one disobeyed one of the Chosen. Not more than once.
Then find what I want! Samael roared. I know it's hidden somewhere in this Kajasic flyspeck of a city. Terangreal, Angreal, even Saangreal. I have tracked them, traced them. Now you find them, Carradin. Do not make me grow impatient. Great Master.
He worked his mouth to find moisture.
Great Master. There are witches. Aes Sedai here. I cannot be sure how many. If they hear a whisper.
If they hear a whisper. Waving him to silence, Samael paced a few quick steps, three times up and back, hands clasped behind his back. He did not look worried, only considering. Finally, he nodded. I will send you someone to deal with these Aes Sedai. He barked a short laugh. I almost wish I could see their faces. Very well. You have a little while longer, then perhaps someone else will have a chance. He lifted a strand of Cheyenne's hair with a finger. She still did not move. Her eyes stared unblinking. This child would certainly leap at the opportunity. Carradine fought down a stab of fear. The Chosen cast down as quickly as they raised up. And as often. Failure never went unpunished.
Great Master, the favor I asked of you. If I might know, have you... will you...
There is very little luck in you, Carradine, Samael said with another smile. You had better hope you have more carrying out my orders.
It seems that someone is making sure at least some of Ishmael's commands are still carried out. He was smiling, but he seemed far from amused. Or perhaps it was just the scar. You failed him, and you've lost your entire family for it. Only my hand protects you now. Once, long ago, I saw three Murdral make a man give them his wife and his daughters one by one, then beg them to cut off his right leg, then the left, then his arms, and burn out his eyes. The perfectly ordinary conversational tone made the recitation worse than any shouts or snarls ever could have. It was a game with them, you understand, to see how much they could make him beg them to take. They left his tongue for last, of course, but there wasn't a great deal of him remaining by then. He had been quite powerful, handsome, and famous. Envied. No one would ever envy what they finally tossed to the Trollocs. You wouldn't believe the sounds it made. Find what I want, Corridon. You will not like it if I withdraw my hand. Abruptly, there was a vertical line of light in the air before the Chosen. It seemed to turn in some fashion, widening as it did into a square hole. Corridon gaped. He was staring through a hole in the air at somewhere full of gray columns and thick mist. Samael stepped through, and the opening snapped shut, a brilliant bar of light that vanished, leaving only a purple afterimage glowing in Cardin's eyes. Unsteadily, he pushed himself to his feet. Failure was always punished, but no one survived disobeying one of the Chosen. Suddenly, Cheyenne moved, completing her halted rise from the chair. "You mark me, Bors," she began, then cut off, staring at the window where he had been standing. Her eyes darted, found him, and she jumped. He could have been one of the Chosen himself from the way those eyes bulged. No one survived disobeying the Chosen. He pressed his hands against his temples. His head felt tight to bursting. "There is a man in the city. Matt Cawthon. You will..." She gave a small start, and he frowned. "You know him?" "I have heard the name," she said warily, and angrily, he would have said. "Few linked to Althor remain unknown for long." As he stepped closer, she crossed her arms protectively in front of herself, and held her place with an obvious effort. "What is a seedy farm boy doing in Ebudar? How did he—"
"Don't bother me with foolish questions, Cheyenne."
His head had never hurt like this. Never. It felt as though a dagger was being driven into his skull between his eyes. No one survived. "You will put your circle to locating Cawthon immediately. All of them." Old Cully was coming tonight, slipping in through the back of the stables. She did not need to know there would be others. "Nothing else is to get in the way."
"But I thought—"
She broke off with a gasp as he seized her neck. A slim dagger appeared in her hand, but he wrenched it away. She twisted and jerked, but he drove her face down onto the table, her cheek smudging still damp ink on the discarded letter to Pedro Nile. The dagger, stabbing down just in front of her eyes, froze her. By chance, the blade piercing the paper had caught an ant by the tip of one leg. It struggled as vainly as she had.
"You are an insect, Millie."
The pain in his head made his voice rasp.
"It is time you understand that. One insect is much like another, and if one won't do—"
Her eyes followed his thumb down, and when it flattened on the ant, she flinched.
"I live to serve and obey, master," she breathed.
She had said that to old Cully every time he saw them together, but never before to him. "And this is how you will obey." No one survived disobedience. No one. Chapter 16. A Touch on the Cheek. The Tarasin Palace was a mass of shining marble and white plaster, with screened balconies of white-painted wrought iron and columned walks, as much as 4 stories above the ground. Pigeons wheeled around pointed domes and tall balcony-wreathed spires banded in red and green tiles, glittering in the sun. Sharp-arched gates in the palace itself led to various courtyards, and more pierced the high wall hiding the gardens. But deep, snowy white steps, 10 spans wide, climbed on the side facing Malhara Square, to great doors carved in coiling patterns like the balcony screens, and covered with beaten gold. The dozen or so guards lined up before those doors, sweating in the sun, wore gilded breastplates over green coats and baggy white trousers stuffed into dark green boots. Green cords secured thick twists of white cloth around glittering golden helmets, with the long ends hanging down their backs. Even their halberds and the scabbards of their daggers and short swords shone with gold. Guards were being looked at, not fighting. But then, when Matt reached the top, he could see swordsmen's calluses on their hands. Always before he had entered through one of the stable yards to peruse the palace horses in passing, but this time he was going in the way a lord would. "The light's blessing on all here," he said to their officer, a man not much older than he. Abu Dhari were polite people. "I've come to leave a message for Nynaeve Sedai and Elaine Sedai, or to give it to them, if they've returned." The officer stared at him, looked at the stairs in consternation. Gold cord as well as green on his pointed helmet signified some rank Matt did not know, and he carried a gilded rod instead of a halberd, with a sharp end and a hook like an ox goad. By his expression, no one had ever come up that way before. Studying Matt's coat, he mulled it over visibly, and at last decided he could not tell him to go away. With a sigh, the man murmured a benison in return and asked Matt's name, pushed open a small door in one of the larger, and ushered him into a grand entry hall, encircled by 5 stone-railed balconies beneath a domed ceiling painted like the sky, complete with clouds and a sun. The guard's snapping fingers summoned a slim young serving woman in a white dress, sewn up on the left to show green petticoats, and embroidered on the left breast, with a green anchor and sword. She scurried across the red and blue marble floor, looking startled, curtsying to Matt and the officer each. Short black hair framed a sweetly pretty face, with silken olive skin, and her livery had the deep, narrow neckline common to all women except nobles in Abu Dhar. For once, Matt did not really notice. When she heard what he wanted, her big black eyes widened even more. Aes Sedai were not unpopular in Abu Dhar, exactly, but most Abu Dhari would go a long distance out of their way to avoid one. "Yes, Sword Lieutenant," she said, bobbing again. "Of course, Sword Lieutenant. May it please you to follow me, my lord." It did. Outside, Abu Dhar sparkled white, but inside, color ran wild. There seemed to be miles of broad corridor in the palace, and here the ceiling was blue and the walls yellow, there the walls pale red and the ceiling green, changing with every turn, combinations to jar any eye but a tinker's. Matt's boots sounded loud on the floor tiles that made patterns of 2 or 3 or sometimes 4 colors in diamonds or stars or triangles. Wherever hallways crossed, the floor was a mosaic of tiny tiles, intricate swirls and scrolls and loops. A few silk tapestries displayed scenes of the sea, and arched niches held carved crystal bowls and small statues and yellow seafolk porcelain that would fetch a fine penny anywhere. Occasionally, a liveried servant hurried along silently, often as not carrying a silver tray or a golden. Normally, displays of wealth made Matt feel comfortable. For one thing, where there was money, some might stick to his fingers. This time he felt impatient, more so by the step, and anxious. The last time he had felt the dice rolling so hard in his head was just before he found himself with 300 of the band, 1,000 of Gabriel's white lions on a ridge to his front, and another 1,000 coming hard up the road behind him, when all he had been trying to do was ride away from the entire mess. That time he had avoided the chop by the grace of other men's memories and more luck than he had a right to. The dice almost always meant danger and something else he had not figured out yet. The prospect of having his skull cracked was not enough, and once or twice there had been no possibility of such, yet the upcoming likelihood of Matt Cawthon dead in some spectacular fashion seemed the most usual cause. Unlikely, maybe, in the Tarasin Palace,
but unlikely did not make the dice go away. He was going to leave his message, grab Nynaeve and Elaine by the scruff of the neck if he had an opportunity, give them a talking to that made their ears glow, and then get out. The young woman glided ahead of him until they reached a short, bullish man, a little older than she, another servant, in tight white breeches, a white shirt with wide sleeves, and a long green vest with the anchor and sword of House Mitzobar in a white disk. "Master Jen," she said, curtsying once more, "this is Lord Matt Cawthon, who wishes to leave a message for the honored Elaine Aes Sedai and the honored Nynaeve Aes Sedai." "Very good, Hazel. You may go." He bowed to Matt. "May it please you to follow me, my lord." Jen led him as far as a dark, grim-faced woman, short of her middle years, and bowed. "Mistress Karen, this is Lord Matt Cawthon, who wishes to leave a message for the honored Elaine Aes Sedai and the honored Nynaeve Aes Sedai." "Very good, Jen. You may go. May it please you to follow me, my lord."
Karen took him up a sweeping flight of marble stairs, the risers painted yellow and red, to a skinny woman named Matilda, who handed him over to a stout fellow named Bren, who led him to a balding man named Maddock, each a little older than the one before. Where five quarters met like the spokes of a wheel, Maddock left him with a round woman called Laren, who had a touch of gray at her temples, and a stately carriage. Like Karen and Matilda, she wore what the Ebudari called a marriage knife, hanging hilt down from a close-fitting silver necklace between more than plump breasts. Five white stones in the hilt, two set in red, and four red stones, one surrounded by black, said three of her nine children were dead, two sons in duels. Rising out of her curtsy to Matt, Laren began to float up one of the hallways, but he hurried to catch her arm. Dark eyebrows rose slightly as she glanced at his hand. She had no dagger except the marriage knife, but he released her immediately. Custom said she could only use that on her husband, yet there was no point in pushing. He did not soften his voice, though. "How far do I have to go to leave a note? Show me to their rooms. A pair of Aes Sedai shouldn't be that hard to find. This isn't the Bloody White Tower." "Aes Sedai," a woman said behind him in a heavy Ilianer accent. "If you do seek two Aes Sedai, you have found two." Laren's face did not change, or almost not. Her nearly black eyes darted past him, and he was sure they tightened with worry. Doffing his hat, Matt turned, wearing an easy smile. With that silver fox head around his neck, Aes Sedai did not put him off at all. Well, not very much. It had those flaws. Maybe the smile was not that easy. The two women confronting him could not have been more different. One was slender, with a fetching smile, in a gold and green dress that showed a hint of what he judged to be a fine bosom. Except for that ageless face, he might have thought to strike up a conversation. It was a pretty face, with eyes large enough for a man to sink into. A pity. The other one had the ageless face, too, but seeing it took him a moment. He thought she was scowling until he realized that must be her normal expression. Her dark, almost black dress covered her to the wrists and chin, for which he was grateful. She looked scrawny as an old bramble. She looked as if she ate brambles for breakfast. "I'm trying to leave a message for Nynaeve and Elaine," he told them. "This woman..." He blinked, looking down each of the corridors. Servants hurried by, but Laren was nowhere in sight. He would not have thought she could move so fast. "Anyway, I want to leave a note." Suddenly cautious, he added, "Are you friends of theirs?" "Not exactly," the pretty one said. "I am Jolene, and this is Teslin. And you are Matt Cawthon." Matt's stomach tightened. Nine Aes Sedai in the palace, and he had to walk into the two who followed Elida, and one of them red. Not that he had anything to fear. He lowered his hand to his side before it could touch the fox head under his clothes. The one who ate brambles, Teslin, stepped closer. She was a sitter, according to Tom, though what a sitter was doing here even Tom did not understand.
"We would be their friends if we could. They do need friends, Master Cawthon, as do you."
Her eyes tried to dig holes in his head. Jolene moved to flank him, laying a hand on his lapel.
He would have considered that smile inviting from another woman. She was Green Aja. They are on dangerous ground and blind to what lies beneath their feet. I know you are their friend. You might show it by telling them to abandon this nonsense before it is too late. Foolish children who go too far can find themselves punished quite severely.
Matt wanted to back away. Even Teslin stood close enough to be almost touching him. Instead, he put on his most insolent grin. It had always landed him in trouble back home, but it seemed appropriate. Those dice in his head could have nothing to do with this pair, or they would have stopped spinning. And he did have the medallion.
They see pretty well, I'd say.
Nynaeve badly needed to be snatched down a peg or six, and Elaine even more, but he was not about to stand by and listen to this woman talk Nynaeve down. If that meant defending Elaine, too, so be it.
Maybe you should abandon your nonsense.
Jolene's smile vanished, but Teslin replaced it with one of her own, a razored smile.
We do know about you, Master Cawthon.
She looked a woman who wanted to skin something, and whoever was handy would do.
Taviren, it do be said. With dangerous associations of your own. That do be more than hearsay.
Jolene's face was ice.
A young man in your position who wished to be assured of his future could do much worse than seek the protection of the tower. You should never have left it.
His stomach clenched tighter. What else did they know? Surely not about the medallion. Nynaeve and Elaine knew, and Adelais and Vandine, and the light only knew who they had told, but surely not this pair.
There was worse than Taviren or the Foxhead, though, or even Rand, as far as he was concerned. If they knew about the bloody horn...
Abruptly, he was yanked away from them so hard that he stumbled and nearly dropped his hat. A slender woman with a smooth face and nearly white hair, gathered at the back of her neck, had him by sleeve and lapel. Reflexively, Teslin seized him the same way on the other side. He recognized the straight-backed newcomer in her plain gray dress, in a way. She was either Adelais or Vandine, two sisters, real sisters, not just Aes Sedai, who might as well have been twins. He could never tell them apart for certain. She and Teslin stared at one another, chill and serene, two cats with a paw on the same mouse.
"No need to tear my coat off," he growled, trying to shrug free. "My coat?"
He was not sure they heard. Even wearing the fox head, he was not prepared to go as far as prying their fingers free, unless he had to. Two other Aes Sedai accompanied whichever sister it was, though one, a dark, stocky woman with inquisitive eyes, was marked by no more than the great serpent ring— and the brown-fringed shawl she wore, displaying the white flame of Tarvalin among vines on her back. She appeared to be just a little older than Nynaeve, which made her Saritha Tomaris, only 2 years or so Aes Sedai.
"Do you stoop to kidnapping men in the halls now, Teslin?"
the other one said.
"A man who cannot channel can hardly be of interest to you."
Short and pale in lace-trimmed gray, slashed with blue, she was all cool, ageless elegance and confident smile. A Kyrianan accent identified her.
He had certainly attracted the top dogs in the yard.
Tom had not been sure whether Jolene or Teslin was in charge of Elida's embassy, but Merlilla led the one from those idiots who had tricked Egwene into becoming their Armelin. Matt could have shaved with Teslin's return smile.
"Do not dissemble with me, Merlilla. Matt Cawthon do be of considerable interest. He should no be running loose."
As if he was not standing there listening.
"Don't fight over me," he said.
Tugging his coat was not making anyone let go. "There's enough to go around." Five sets of eyes made him wish he had kept his mouth shut.
Aes Sedai had no sense of humor.
He pulled a little harder, and Vandine, or Adelais, jerked back hard enough to pull the coat out of his hand. Vandine, he decided. She was green, and he had always thought she wanted to turn him upside down and shake the secret of the medallion out of him. Whichever she was, she smiled, part knowing, part amused. He saw nothing funny. The others did not look at him long. He might as well have vanished.
"What he needs," Jolene said firmly, "is to be taken into custody, for his own protection and more. Three Taviren coming out of a single village. And one of them the dragon reborn? Master Cawthon should be sent to the White Tower immediately."
and he had thought her pretty. Marilla only shook her head.
You overestimate your situation here, Jolene, if you think I will simply allow you to take the boy. You overestimate yours, Melilla.
Jolene stepped closer until she was looking down at the other woman. Her lips curved, superior and condescending.
Or do you understand that it's only a wish not to offend Tylan that keeps us from confining all of you on bread and water until you can be returned to the tower?
Matt expected Melilla to laugh in her face, but she shifted her head slightly as if she really wanted to break away from Jolene's gaze.
You would not dare.
Sarita wore Aes Sedai tranquility like a mask, face smooth and hands calmly adjusting her shawl, but her breathy voice shouted that it was a mask.
These are children's games, Jolene,
Van Deen murmured dryly. Surely that was who she was. She was the only one of the three who really did appear unruffled. Faint splashes of color blossomed on Merlilla's cheeks as if the white-haired woman had spoken to her, but her own gaze steadied.
You can hardly expect us to go meekly, she told Jolene firmly, and there are five of us. Seven, counting Nynaeve and Elaine.
The last was a clear afterthought, and reluctant at that. Jolene arched an eyebrow. Teslin's bony fingers did not loosen their grip any more than Van Deen's, but she studied Jolene and Merlillo with an unreadable expression.
Aes Sedai were a country of strangers, where you never knew what to expect until it was too late. There were deep currents here. Deep currents around Aes Sedai could snatch a man to his death without them so much as noticing. Maybe it was time to start prying at fingers.
Laren's sudden reappearance saved him the effort. Struggling to control her breath, as if she had been running, the plump woman spread her skirts in a curtsy, markedly deeper than she had given him.
"Forgiveness for disturbing you, Aes Sedai, but the Queen summons Lord Cawthon. Forgiveness, please. It's more than my ears are worth if I don't bring him straight away."
The Aes Sedai looked at her, all of them, till she began to fidget. Then the two groups stared at one another as if trying to see who could out-Aes Sedai who. And then they looked at him. He wondered whether anybody was going to move.
"I can't keep the Queen waiting now, can I?" he said cheerily.
From the sniffs, you would have thought he had pinched somebody's bottom. Even Laren's brows drew down in disapproval.
"Release him, Adelius,"
Merlilla said finally. He frowned as the white-haired woman complied. "Those two ought to wear little signs with their names or different color hair ribbons or something." She gave him another of those amused, knowing smiles. He hated that. It was a woman's trick, not just Aes Sedai, and they usually did not know anything at all like what they wanted you to believe.
"Teslin," he said.
The grim red still had hold of his coat with both hands. She peered up at him, ignoring everyone else.
"The Queen?"
Merlilla opened her mouth and hesitated, obviously changing what she had been going to say.
"How long do you intend to stand here holding him, Teslin? Perhaps you will try to explain to Tylan why her summons is disregarded." "Consider well who you do tie yourself to, Master Cawthon," Teslin said, still looking only at him. "Wrong choices can lead to an unpleasant future, even for a Taviran. Consider well."
Then she let go. As he followed Laren, he did not allow himself to show his eagerness to be away, but he did wish the woman would walk a little faster. She glided along ahead of him, regal as any queen. Regal as any Aes Sedai. When they reached the first turning, he looked over his shoulder. The five Aes Sedai were still standing there, staring after him. As if his look had been a signal, they exchanged silent glances and went, each in a different direction. Adelaus came toward him, but a dozen steps before reaching him, she smiled at him again and disappeared through a doorway. Deep currents. He preferred swimming where his feet could touch the bottom of the pond. Laren was waiting around the corner, hands on broad hips and her face much too smooth. Beneath her skirts, he suspected her foot was tapping impatiently. He gave her his most winning smile. Giggling girls or gray-haired grandmothers, women softened for that one. It had won him kisses and eased him out of predicaments more often than he could count.
It was almost as good as flowers. That was neatly done, and I thank you. I'm sure the Queen doesn't really want to see me.
If she did, he did not want to see her.
Everything he thought about nobles was tripled for royalty. Nothing he had found in those old memories changed that, and some of those fellows had spent considerable time around kings and queens and the like. Now, if you will just show me where Nynaeve and Elaine stay... Strangely, the smile did not seem to have any effect. I would not lie, Lord Cawthon. It would be more than my years are worth. The Queen is waiting, my lord. You are a very brave man, she added, turning, then said something more under her breath. Or a very great fool. He doubted he had been supposed to hear that. A choice between going to see the Queen and wandering miles of corridor until he stumbled on somebody who would tell him what he wanted to know? He went to see the Queen. Tylin Quintara, by the grace of the light, Queen of Altara, Mistress of the Four Winds, Guardian of the Sea of Storms, High Seat of House Mitsubar, awaited him in a room with yellow walls and a pale blue ceiling, standing before a huge white fireplace with a stone lintel carved into a stormy sea. She was well worth seeing, he decided. Tylin was not young. The shiny black hair cascading over her shoulders had gray at the temples, and faint lines webbed the corners of her eyes. Nor was she exactly pretty, though the two thin scars on her cheeks had nearly vanished with age. Handsome came closer, but she was imposing. Large dark eyes regarded him majestically, an eagle's eyes. She had little real power. A man could ride beyond her writ in 2 or 3 days and still have a lot of Altara ahead. But he thought she might even make an Aes Sedai step back. Like Isabella of Dal Kalain, who had made the Amarlan Angara come to her. That was one of the old memories. Dal Kalain had vanished in the Trolloc Wars. Majesty, he said, sweeping his hat wide in a bow and flourishing an imaginary cloak, by your summons do I come. Imposing or not, it was hard to keep his eyes away from the not-small lace-trimmed oval where her white-sheathed marriage knife hung. A very nicely rounded sight indeed. Yet the more bosom a woman displayed, the less she wanted you to look. Openly, at least. White-sheathed. But he already knew she was a widow. Not that it mattered. He would as soon tangle himself with that fox-faced dark friend as with a queen. Not looking at all was difficult, but he managed. Most likely she would call guards rather than draw the gem-encrusted dagger thrust behind a woven gold belt to match the collar her marriage knife hung from. Maybe that was why the dice were still rolling in his head. The possibility of an encounter with the headsman would set them spinning if anything did. Layered silk petticoats rippled white and yellow as she crossed the room and walked slowly all the way around him. "You speak the old tongue," she said, once she stood in front of him again. Her voice was low-pitched and musical. Without waiting for a reply, she glided to a chair and sat, adjusting her green skirts. An unconscious gesture, her gaze remained fixed on him. He thought she could probably tell when his small clothes had been washed last. "You wish to leave a message? I have what is necessary." A lace fall at her wrist swayed as she gestured to a small writing table standing beneath a gilt-framed mirror. All the furnishings were gilded and carved like bamboo. Tall, triple-arched windows opening onto a wrought-iron balcony admitted a sea breeze that was surprisingly pleasant, if not exactly cool. Yet Matt felt hotter than in the street, and it had nothing to do with her stare. "Deyenayi, diu ninte concion kalietye." That was what he had said. The bloody old tongue popping out of his mouth again, without him knowing it. He had thought he had that little bother under control. No telling when those bloody dice would stop, or for what. Best to keep his eyes to himself and his mouth shut as much as possible. "I thank you, Majesty." He made very sure of those words. Thick sheets of pale paper already waited on the slanted table, at a comfortable height for writing. He propped his hat against the table leg. He could see her in the mirror, watching. Why had he let his tongue run loose? Dipping a golden pen, what else would a queen have?
He composed what he wanted to write in his head before bending over the paper with an arm curled around it. His hand was awkward and square. He had no love of writing. I followed a dark friend to the palace Jakim Karadin is renting. She tried to kill me once, and maybe Rand as well. She was greeted like an old friend of the house. For a moment he studied that, biting the end of the pen before realizing he was scoring the soft gold. Maybe Tylin would not notice. They needed to know about Karadin. What else? He added a few more reasonably worded lines. The last thing he wanted to do was put their backs up. Be sensible. If you have to go traipsing around, let me send a few men along to keep you from having your head split open. Anyway, isn't it about time I took you back to Egwene? There's nothing here but heat and flies, and we can find plenty of those in Camelin. There. They could not ask for pleasanter than that. Blotting the page carefully, he folded it four times. Sand in a small golden bowl covered a coal. He puffed on it till it glowed, then used it to light a candle and picked up the stick of red wax. As the sealing wax dripped onto the edges of the paper, it suddenly struck him that he had a signet ring in his pocket. Just something the ringmaker had carved to show his skill, but better than a plain lump. The ring was slightly longer than the pool of solidifying wax, yet most of the sigil took. For the first time, he got a good look at what he had bought. Inside a border of large crescents, a running fox seemed to have startled two birds into flight. That made him grin. Too bad it was not a hand, for the band, but appropriate enough. He certainly needed to be crafty as a fox to keep up with Nynaeve and Elaine, and if they were not exactly flighty, well... Besides, the medallion had made him fond of foxes. He scrawled Nynaeve's name on the outside, and then Elaine's, as an afterthought. One or the other, they should see it soon. Turning with the sealed letter held in front of him, he gave a start as his knuckles brushed against Tylin's bosom. He stumbled back against the writing table, staring and trying not to turn red. Staring at her face. Just her face. He had not heard her approach. Best to simply ignore the brushing, not embarrass her any further. She probably thought he was a clumsy lout as it was. "There is something in this you should know, Majesty." Insufficient room remained between them to lift the letter. "Jakim Karadin is entertaining dark friends, and I don't mean arresting them." "You are certain?" "Of course you are. No one would make that charge without being certain." A furrow creased her brow, but she gave her head a shake, and the frown disappeared. "Let us speak of more pleasant things." He could have yelped. He told her the White Cloak ambassador to her court was a dark friend, and all she did was grimace. "You are Lord Matt Cawthon?" There was just a hint of question in the title. Her eyes minded him more than ever of an eagle's. A queen could not like someone coming to her pretending to be a lord. "Just Matt Cawthon." Something told him she would hear a lie. Besides, letting people think he was a lord was just a ruse, one he would rather have managed without. In Ebu Dar you could find a duel any time you turned around, but few challenged lords except other lords. As it was, in the last month he had cracked a number of heads, bloodied four men and run half a mile to escape a woman. Tylin's stare made him nervous, and those dice still rattled about in his skull. He wanted out of here. "If you'll tell me where to leave the letter, Majesty." "The daughter heir and Nynaeve Sedai seldom mention you," she said. "But one learns to hear what is not said." Casually, she reached up and touched his cheek. He half raised his own hand, uncertainly. Had he smeared ink there, chewing the pen? Women did like to tidy things, including men. Maybe queens did, too. "What they do not say, but I hear, is that you are an untamed rogue, a gambler and chaser after women." Her eyes held his, expression never altering a hair, and her voice stayed firm and cool, but as she spoke, her fingers stroked his other cheek. "Untamed men are often the most interesting to talk to." A finger outlined his lips. "An untamed rogue who travels with Aes Sedai, a Ta'veren who, I think, makes them a little afraid, uneasy at the least.
It takes a man with a strong liver to make Aes Sedai uneasy. How will you bend the pattern in Ebu Dar, just Matt Coffin?
Her hand settled against his neck. He could feel his pulse throbbing against her fingers. His mouth fell open. The writing table behind his back rattled against the wall as he tried to back away. The only way out was to push her aside or climb over her skirts. Women did not behave this way. Oh, some of those old memories suggested they did. But it was mainly memories of memories, that woman had done this or this woman had done that. The things he recalled clearly were battles for the most part, and no help here at all. She smiled, a faint curl of her lips that did not lessen the predatory gleam in her eyes. The hair on his head tried to stand up. Her eyes flickered over his shoulder to the mirror, and she turned abruptly, leaving him gaping at her back as she moved away.
"I must arrange to speak with you again, Master Cawthon. I—"
She cut off as the door swung all the way open, apparently surprised, but then he realized she had seen it begin moving in the mirror. A slender young man entered, limping slightly, a dark lad with sharp eyes that flicked by Matt with barely a pause. Black hair hung to his shoulders, and he wore one of those coats that was never meant to be worn normally draped across his shoulders, green silk with a gold chain across his chest and gold leopards worked in the lapels. "Mother," he said, bowing to Tylan and touching his lips with his fingers.
"Veslin."
She filled the name with warmth and kissed him on both cheeks and his eyelids. The firm, even icy tone she had used with Matt might as well have never been.
"It went well, I see."
"Not as well as it might." The boy sighed. Despite his eyes, he had a mild manner to him and a soft voice. "Nevin nicked my leg on the second pass, then slipped on the third, so I ran him through the heart instead of his sword arm. The offense was not worth killing, and now I must pay condolences to his widow." He seemed to regret that as much as this Nevin's death. Tylan's beaming face hardly seemed right on a woman whose son had just told her he had killed a man.
"Just be sure your visit is brief. Stab my eyes, but Dravindra will be one of those widows who wants comforting. And then you will either have to marry her or kill her brothers."
By her tone, the first alternative was much the worse, the second merely a nuisance.
"This is Master Matt Cawthon, my son. He is Tavirin. I hope you'll make a friend of him. Perhaps you two will go to the Swovan night dances together."
Matt jumped. The last thing he wanted was to go anywhere with a fellow who fought duels and whose mother wanted to stroke Matt Cawthon's cheek. "I am not much for balls," he said quickly. Ebu Dari liked festivals beyond reason. Here High Chaslin was just passed, and they had five more in the next week. Two all-day affairs, not just the simpler evening feasts. "I do my dancing in taverns. The rougher sort, I'm afraid. Nothing you'd like." "I favor taverns of the rougher sort," Veslin said with a smile, in that soft voice. "The balls are for older people, and their pretties." After that, it was all downhill on crumpling shingle. Before Matt knew what was happening, Tylan had him sewed up in a sack. He and Veslin would be attending the festivals together. All of the festivals. Hunting, Veslin called it, and when Matt said hunting for girls without thinking, he would never have said that in front of somebody's mother had he thought. The boy laughed and said, "A girl or a fight, pouting lips or a flashing blade. Whichever dance you're dancing at the moment is always the most fun. Wouldn't you say so, Matt?" Tylan smiled at Veslin fondly. Matt managed a weak laugh. This Veslin was mad. Him and his mother both. Chapter 17. The Triumph of Logic. Matt stalked out of the palace when Tylan finally let him go, and had he thought it would do any good, he would have run. The skin between his shoulder blades prickled so he almost forgot the dice dancing in his head. The worst moment, the very worst of a dozen bad, had been when Veslin teased his mother, saying she should find herself a pretty for the balls, and Tylan laughingly claimed a queen had no time for young men, all the while looking at Matt with those bloody eagle's eyes. Now he knew why rabbits ran so fast. He stumped across Molhara Square, not seeing anything. Had Nynaeve and Elaine been cavorting with Jacob Carden and Elida in the fountain beneath that statue of some long-dead queen,
two spans or more tall and pointing to the sea, he would have passed by without a second look. The common room of the wandering woman was dim and comparatively cool after the bright heat outside. He took off his hat gratefully. A faint haze of pipe smoke hung in the air, but the arabesque-carved shutters across the wide-arched windows let in more than enough light. Some bedraggled pine branches had been tied above the windows for a Swovan night. In one corner, two women with flutes and a fellow with a small drum between his knees provided a shrill, pulsing sort of music that Matt had come to like. Even at this time of the day, there were a few patrons, outland merchants in moderately plain woolens, with a sprinkling of Ebu Dare, most in the vests of various guilds. No apprentices or even journeymen here. So close to the palace, the wandering woman was hardly an inexpensive place to drink or eat, much less sleep. The rattle of dice at a table in the corner echoed the feel in his head, but he turned the other way to where three of his men sat on benches around another table. Korovin, a thickly muscled Kyrianin with a nose that made his eyes seem even smaller than they were, sat stripped to the waist, holding his tattooed arms over his head, while Vannin wound strips of bandage around his middle. Vannin was three times Korovin's size, but he looked like a balding sack of suet overflowing his bench. His coat appeared to have been slept in for a week. It always did, even an hour after one of the serving women ironed it. Some of the merchants eyed the three uneasily, but none of the Ebu Dare. Men or women, they had seen the same or worse, often. Harnan, a lantern-jawed Tyran file leader with a crude tattoo of a hawk on his left cheek, was berating Korovin. Harnan, a lantern-jawed Tyran file leader with a crude tattoo of a hawk on his left cheek, was berating Korovin.
"Don't care what the flaming fish seller said, you goat-spawn toad. You use your bloody club, and don't go accepting flaming challenges just because—"
He cut off when he saw Matt, and he tried to look as if he had not been saying what he had. He just looked as if he had a toothache. If Matt asked, it would turn out Korovin had slipped and fallen on his own dagger, or some such foolery Matt was supposed to pretend to believe. So he just leaned his fists on the table as if he saw nothing out of the ordinary. Truth to tell, it was not that out of the ordinary. Vannin was the only man who had not been in two dozen scrapes already. For some reason, men looking for trouble walked as wide of Vannin as they did Nalesian. The only difference was that Vannin seemed to like it that way. "Has Tom or Julin been here yet?" Vannin did not look up from tying the bandages.
"Haven't seen hide, hair, nor toenail. Nalesian was in for a bit, though."
There was no milord nonsense from Vannin. He made no bones about not liking nobles, with the unfortunate exception of Elaine.
"Left an iron-strapped chest up in your room, and went out blabbing about trinkets."
He made as if to spit through the gap in his teeth, then glanced at one of the serving women and did not. Mistress Annan was death on anybody spitting on her floors, or tossing bones, or even tapping out a pipe.
"The boy's out back in the stable," he went on before Matt could ask, "with his book and one of the innkeeper's daughters. Another of the girls spanked his bottom for pinching hers."
Finishing the last knot, he gave Matt an accusatory look, as if it had been his fault in some way.
"Poor little mite," Korovin muttered, twisting to see whether the bandages would stay in place.
He had a leopard and a boar inked on one arm, a lion and a woman on the other. The woman did not seem to be wearing much except her hair.
"Sniveling he was, though he did brighten when Leral let him hold her hand."
The men all looked after Oliver like a gaggle of uncles, though certainly the sort no mother would want near her son.
"He'll live," Matt said dryly.
The boy was probably picking up these habits from his uncles. Next they would give him a tattoo. At least Oliver had not sneaked out to run with the street children. He seemed to enjoy that almost as much as he did making himself a nuisance to grown women.
"Harnan, you wait here, and if you see Tom or Julin, collar them. Bannon, I want you to see what you can learn around the Chelsane Palace, over near the Three Towers gate."
Hesitating, he looked over the room. Serving women drifted in and out of the kitchens with food and, more often, drink. Most of the patrons seemed intent on their silver cups, though a pair of women in weaver's vests argued quietly, ignoring their wine punch and leaning across the table at one another. Some of the merchants appeared to be haggling, waving hands and dipping fingers in their drinks to scribble numbers on the table. The music should mask his words from eavesdroppers, but he lowered his voice anyway. News that Jacob Carradine had dark friends coming to call screwed Bannon's round face into a scowl, as if he might spit no matter who saw. Harnan muttered something about filthy white cloaks, and Korovin suggested denouncing Carradine to the civil guard. That got such disgusted looks from the other two that he buried his face in a cup of ale. He was one of the few men Matt knew who could drink Abu Dhari ale in this heat, or drink it at all, for that matter. "Be careful," Matt warned when Vannon stood. It was not that he was worried, really. Vannon moved with surprising lightness for such a fat man. He was the best horse thief in two countries at the least, and could slip by even a warder unseen. But they're a nasty lot, white cloaks or dark friends, either one. The man only grunted and motioned for Korovin to gather his shirt and coat and come along. "My lord," Harnan said as they left.
"My lord, I heard there was a fog in the Rahad yesterday."
On the point of turning away, Matt stopped. Harnan looked worried, and nothing much worried him. "What do you mean, a fog? In this heat, fog thick as porridge would not last a heartbeat." The file-eater shrugged uncomfortably and peered into his mug.
"A fog. I heard there was things in it."
He looked up at Matt.
"I heard people just disappeared. And some was found eaten. Parts of them."
Matt managed not to shiver. "The fog's gone, isn't it? You weren't in it. Worry when you are. That's all you can do." Harnan frowned doubtfully, but that was the pure truth. These bubbles of evil, that was what Rand had called them, what Moraine had, burst where and when they chose, and there did not seem to be anything even Rand could do to stop them. Worrying about it did as much good as worrying about whether a roof tile would fall on your head in the street tomorrow. Less, since you could decide to stay indoors. There was something that was worth worrying over, though. Nalesian had left their winnings sitting upstairs. Bloody nobles tossed gold around like water. Leaving Harnan studying his mug, Matt headed for the railless stairs at the back of the room. But before he reached them, one of the serving women accosted him. Kyra was a slender, full-lipped girl with smoky eyes.
"A man came in looking for you, my lord," she said, twisting her skirts from side to side and looking up at him through long lashes. There was a certain smokiness in her voice, too. "Said he was an illuminator. But he looked seedy to me. He ordered a meal and left when Mistress Anan wouldn't give it. He wanted you to pay."
"Next time, pigeon, give the meal," he told her, slipping a silver mark into the plunging neck of her dress. "I'll speak to Mistress Anan." He did want to find an illuminator, a real one, not some fellow selling fireworks full of sawdust. But it hardly mattered now. Not with the gold lying unguarded. And fogs in the Rahad, and dark friends, and Aes Sedai, and bloody Tylin, taking leave of her senses, and... Kyra giggled and twisted like a stroked cat.
"Would you like me to bring some punch to your room, my lord? Or anything?"
She smiled hopefully, invitingly. "Maybe later," he said, tapping her nose with a fingertip. She giggled again. She always did. Kyra would have her skirt sewn to show petticoats to the middle of her thigh or higher, had Mistress Anan allowed it, but the innkeeper looked after her serving women almost as closely as she did her daughters. Almost.
Maybe later.
Trotting up the wide stone stairs, he put Kyra out of his mind. What was he to do about Olver? The boy would find himself in real trouble one day if he thought he could treat women that way. He was going to have to keep him away from Harnan and the others as much as possible, he supposed. They were a bad influence on a boy. To have this on top of everything else. He had to get Nynaeve and Elaine out of Ebu Dar before something worse went wrong. His room was at the front, with windows overlooking the square, and as he reached for the door, the hallway floor behind him squeaked. In 100 inns, it would not even have registered. But the floors in the Wandering Woman did not squeak. He looked back, and spun just in time to drop his hat and catch the descending truncheon with his left hand instead of his skull. The blow stung his hand to numbness, but he held on desperately as thick fingers dug into his throat, forcing him back against the door to his room. His head hit with a thump. Silver-rimmed black spots danced in his vision, obscuring a sweating face. All he could really see was a big nose and yellow teeth, and those seemed hazy. Suddenly he realized he was on the far edge of consciousness. Those fingers were closing off blood to his brain along with air. His free hand went beneath his coat, fumbling over the hilts of his knives as though his fingers no longer remembered what they were for. The cudgel wrenched free. He could see it rising, feel it rising to smash his skull. Focusing everything, he jerked a knife from its scabbard and thrust. His attacker let out a high-pitched scream, and Matt was vaguely aware of the club bouncing off his shoulder as it fell to the floor, but the man did not let go of his throat. Stumbling, Matt drove him back, tearing at the clutching fingers with one hand, driving his knife repeatedly with the other. Abruptly, the fellow fell, sliding from Matt's blade. The knife nearly followed him to the floor. So did Matt. Gulping breath, sweet air, he clung to something, a doorway, to hold himself on his feet. From the floor, a plain-faced man stared up at him with eyes that would never see anything again. A heavy-set fellow with curled Mirandian mustaches, in a dark blue coat, fit for a small merchant or a prosperous shopkeeper. Not the look of a thief about him at all. Abruptly, he realized they had stumbled through an open door in their fight. It was a smaller room than Matt's, windowless, a pair of oil lamps on small tables beside the narrow bed providing a murky illumination. A lanky, pale-haired man straightened from a long open chest, staring oddly at the corpse. The chest took up most of the free space in the room. Matt opened his mouth to apologize for intruding so roughly, and the lanky man snatched a long dagger from his belt, a cudgel from the bed, and leaped over the chest at him. That had not been the look you give a dead stranger. Clinging unsteadily to the doorframe, Matt threw underhanded, the hilt no sooner leaving his hand than he was scrabbling under his coat for another. His knife struck squarely in the other man's throat, and Matt almost fell again, this time from relief, as the man clutched himself, blood spurting between his fingers, and toppled backward into the open chest.
"It's good to be lucky," Matt croaked.
Staggering, he retrieved his knife, wiping it clean on the fellow's gray coat. A better coat than the other, still wool, but of a better cut. A lesser lord would not have been ashamed to wear it. Andron by the collar. He sank onto the bed, frowning at the man sprawled in the chest. A noise made him look up. His manservant was in the doorway, trying unsuccessfully to hide a large black iron frying pan behind his back. Nerim kept a full set of pots, and everything else he thought a lord's servant might need traveling, in the small room he shared with Alver next to Matt's. He was short, even for a Kyrianin, and skinny to boot.
"My lord has blood on his coat again, I fear," he murmured in melancholy tones.
The day he sounded anything else, the sun would rise in the west.
"I do wish my lord would be more careful of his clothes. It is so hard to remove blood without a stain, and the insects hardly need any encouragement to eat holes. This place has more insects than I have ever seen, my lord."
No mention at all of two dead men, or what he had intended with the frying pan. That scream had drawn other attention. The wandering woman was not the sort of inn where screams passed unremarked. Feet pounded in the hallway, and Mistress Anan pushed Nerim firmly out of her way and raised her skirts to step around the corpse on the floor. Her husband followed her in, a square-faced, gray-haired man with the double earring of the Ancient and Honorable League of the Nets dangling from his left ear. The two white stones on the lower hoop said he owned other boats beside the one he captained. Jasper Annan was part of the reason Matt was careful not to smile too much at any of Mistress Annan's daughters. The man wore a work knife stuffed behind his belt and a longer curved blade, too, and his long blue and green vest revealed arms and chest crisscrossed with dueling scars. He was alive, though, and most of the men who had given those scars were not. The other reason for caution was Sitala Anan herself. Matt had never before let himself be turned off a girl because of her mother, even if that mother owned the inn where he was staying, but Mistress Anan had a way about her. Large gold hoops in her ears swung as she surveyed the dead men without a flinch. She was pretty, despite a touch of gray in her hair, and her marriage knife nestled in roundness that normally would have drawn his eyes like moths to a candle. Yet looking at her that way would have been like looking at... not his mother. At an Aes Sedai, maybe,
though he had done that, of course, just to look. Or at Queen Tylin, the light helped him there. Putting a finger on why was not easy. She simply had a way about her. It was just difficult to think of doing anything that would offend Sitala Anan. "One of them jumped me in the hall." Matt kicked the chest lightly. It made a hollow sound despite the dead man slumped inside with his arms and legs dangling out. "This is empty, except for him. I think they meant to fill it with whatever they could steal." "The gold, perhaps?" Not likely they could have heard of that, one only hours ago, but he would ask Mistress Anan about a safer place to keep it. She nodded calmly, hazel eyes serene. Men knifed in her end did not ruffle her feathers. "They insisted on carrying it up themselves. Their stock, so they claimed. They took the room just before you came in. For a few hours, they said, to sleep before traveling on toward Norchasen." That was a small village on the coast to the east, but it was unlikely they would have told the truth. Her tone implied as much. She frowned at the dead men as though wishing she could shake them alive to answer questions. "They were picky about the room, though. The pale-haired man was in charge. He turned down the first three he was offered, then accepted this that was meant for a single servant. I thought he was being stingy with a coin." "Even a thief can be tight-fisted," Matt said absently. This could have qualified to start those dice rolling in his head, a head that would have been cracked open for sure without the luck of that fellow stepping on the one board in the whole inn that would squeak. But the bloody things were still tumbling. He did not like it.
"You think it was chance, then, my lord?"
"What else?" She had no answer, but she frowned at the corpses again. Maybe she was not so sanguine as he had thought. She was not native to Ebedar, after all. "Too many roughs in the city of late." Jasper had a deep voice, and speaking normally, he seemed to be barking commands on a fishing boat. "Maybe you ought to think on hiring guards." All Mistress Anan did was lift an eyebrow at her husband, but his hands rose defensively.
"Peace be on you, wife. I spoke without thinking."
Ebedari women were known to express displeasure with a husband in a sharp fashion. It was not beyond possibility that a few of his scars came from her. That marriage knife had several uses. Thanking the light he was not married to an Ebedari, Matt replaced his own knife in its sheath alongside the others. Thank the light he was not married at all. His fingers brushed paper. Mistress Anan was not letting her husband off easily.
"You frequently do, husband," she said, fingering the hilt between her breasts. "Many women would not let it pass. Elinda always tells me I am not firm enough when you speak out of line. I need to provide a good example for my daughters."
Acerbity melted into a smile, if a small one.
"Consider yourself chastised. I will refrain from telling you who should haul which net on which boat."
"You are too kind to me, wife," he replied dryly. There was no guild for innkeepers in Ebedar, but every inn in the city was in the hands of a woman. To Ebedari, bad luck of the worst sort would dog any inn owned by a man, or any vessel owned by a woman. There were no women in the fishermen's guild. Matt pulled out the paper. It was snowy white, expensive, and stiff, and folded small. The few lines on it were printed in square letters, like those Alver might use. Or an adult who did not want the hand recognized. "Elaine and Nynaeve are pushing too far. Remind them they are still in danger from the tower. Warn them to be careful, or they will be kneeling to ask Elida's pardon yet." That was all. No signature. Still in danger? That suggested it was nothing new, and somehow it did not fit with them being snared up by the rebels. No, that was the wrong question. Who had slipped him this note? Obviously somebody who thought they could not simply hand it to him. Who had had the opportunity since he put the coat on this morning? It had not been there then, for sure. Somebody who had gotten close. Somebody... Unbidden, he found himself humming a snatch of "She Dazzles My Eyes and Clouds My Mind." Around here, the tune had different words. They called it upside down and round and round.
Only Teslin or Jolene fit, and that was impossible.
"Bad news, my lord?" Mistress Annan asked.
Matt stuffed the note into his pocket. "Does any man ever get to understand women? I don't mean just Aes Sedai. Any women." Jasper roared, and when his wife directed a meaning gaze his way, he only laughed harder. The look she gave Matt would have shamed an Aes Sedai for its perfect serenity.
"Men have it quite easy, my lord, if they only looked or listened. Women have the difficult task. We must try to understand men."
Jasper took hold of the doorframe, tears rolling down his dark face. She eyed him sideways, tilting her head, then turned, all cool calmness, and punched him under the ribs with her fist so hard that his knees buckled. His laughter took on a wheeze without stopping.
"There is a saying in Ebu Dar, my lord," she said to Matt over her shoulder. "A man is a maze of brambles in darkness, and even he does not know the way."
Matt snorted. Fat lot of help she was.
Well, Teslin or Jolene or somebody else. It must have been somebody else, if he could only think who. The White Tower was a long way away.
Jacob Cardin was right here. He found the two corpses. And so were 100 other scoundrels. Somehow, he would see those two women safely out of Ebu Dar. The trouble was, he did not have a clue how. He wished those bloody dice would stop and be done with it.
The apartments Jolene shared with Teslin were quite spacious, including a bedchamber for each of them, plus one apiece for their maids, and another that would have done quite well for Blairick and Fenn, if Teslin could have stood to have her warders with them. The woman saw every man as a potentially rabid wolf, and there was no gainsaying her when she truly wanted something. As inexorable as Elida, she ground down whatever lay in her path. They stood as equals in every real way, certainly, but not many managed to prevail over Teslin without a clear advantage. She was at the writing table in the sitting room when Jolene entered, her pen making an awful scritch, scritch. She was always parsimonious with the ink. Without a word, Jolene swept by her and out onto the balcony, a long cage of white-painted iron. The scrollwork was so tight that the men working in the garden 3 stories below would have a difficult time seeing that there was anyone within. Flowers in this region ordinarily thrived in heat, wild colors to outshine the interior of the palace, but nothing bloomed down there. Gardeners moved along the gravel walks with buckets of water, yet nearly every leaf was yellow or brown. She would not have admitted it under torture, but the heat made her afraid. The Dark One was touching the world, and their only hope a boy who was running wild. "Bread and water?" Teslin said suddenly. "Send the Cawthon boy off to the tower? If there do be changes in what we did plan, you will please inform me before telling others." Jolene felt a touch of heat in her cheeks. "Marilla needed to be set down. She lectured when I was a novice." So had Teslin, a severe teacher who held her classes with an iron grip. Just the way she spoke was a reminder, a marked warning not to go against her, equal or not. Marilla, though, stood lower. She used to make a stand in front of the class, and she would dig and dig for the answer she wanted, until we stood there in front of everyone, weeping with frustration. She pretended to sympathize, or perhaps she really did, but the more she patted us and told us not to cry, the worse it was. She cut off abruptly. She had not intended to say all that. It was Teslin's fault, always looking at her as if she were about to be abraded for a spot on her dress. But she should understand. Marilla had taught her, too. "You have remembered that all this time?" Stark incredulity painted Teslin's voice. "The sisters who did teach us did only do their duty. Sometimes I do think what Elida did say of you do be right." The annoying scritch-scritch resumed. "Simply came to mind when Marilla began as if she were truly an ambassador, instead of a rebel." Jolene frowned at the garden. She despised every one of those women who had broken the White Tower and flaunted the break before all the world, them and anyone who aided them. But Elida had blundered, too, horribly. The sisters who were rebels now could have been reconciled with a little effort. "What did she say of me? Teslin?" The sound of the pen continued, like fingernails scraping across a slate. Jolene went back inside. What did Elida say? Teslin laid another sheet atop her letter, either to blot or to shield it from Jolene's eyes, but she did not answer immediately. She scowled at Jolene, or perhaps just looked. It was difficult to say with her at times, and at last sighed. Very well, if you must know. She did say you still do be a child. A child? Jolene's shock had no effect on the other woman. Some, Teslin said calmly, do change little from the day they do put on novice white. Some do change no at all. Elida does believe you have no grown up yet, and never will. Jolene tossed her head angrily, unwilling to let herself speak. To have that said by someone whose mother had been a child when she herself gained the shawl. Elida had been petted too much as a novice, made over too much for her strength and the remarkable speed of her learning. Jolene suspected that was why she was in such a fury about Elaine and Egwene and the wilder Nynaeve, because they were stronger than she, because they had spent far less time as novices, no matter that they had been pushed ahead too fast. Why, Nynaeve had never been a novice at all, and that was completely unheard of. Since you did bring it up, Teslin went on, perhaps we should try to take advantage of the situation. What do you mean? Embracing the true source, Jolene channeled air to lift the silver pitcher on the turquoise-inlaid side table and fill a silver goblet with punch. As always, the joy of embracing Sidar thrilled her, soothing even as it exhilarated. It do be obvious, I should think. Elida's orders do still stand. Elaine and Nynaeve are to be returned to the tower as soon as found. I did agree to wait, but perhaps we should wait no longer. A pity the Alvear girl does no be with them. But two will put us back in Elida's good graces, and if we can add the Cawthon boy, I do think those three will make her welcome us as if we did come with Althor himself. And this Avienda will make a fine novice, wilder or no. The goblet floated into Jolene's hand on air, and she reluctantly released the power. She had never lost the ardor she felt the first time she touched the source. Dew melon punch was a poor substitute for Sidar. The worst part of her penance before leaving the tower had been losing the right to touch Sidar. Almost the worst part. She had said it all herself, but Elida had made it clear that if she did not make it harsh, Elida would. She had no doubt the result would have been much worse then. Her good graces? Teslin, she humiliated us for no more reason than to show the others that she could. She sent us to this fly-ridden hole as far from everything important as she could, short of the other side of the Arith Ocean, ambassadors to a queen with less power than a dozen of her own nobles, any one of whom could snatch the throne from her tomorrow if they could be bothered to. And do you want to wheedle your way back into Elida's favor? She do be the Ammerlin seat. Teslin touched the letter with the page lying atop it, moving the sheets a bit this way, then a bit that, as if framing her thoughts. Remaining silent for a time did let her know we are no lapdogs, but remaining silent too long could be seen as treason. Jolene sniffed. Ridiculous! When they're returned, they'll only be punished for running away, and now for pretending to be full sisters. Her mouth tightened. They were both guilty there, and those who allowed them to as well. But it made a sharp difference when one of them claimed her own Aja. By the time the green Aja finished with Elaine for that, it would be a very chastened young woman indeed who took the throne of Andor. Though it might be best if Elaine secured the Lion Throne first. Her training had to be completed either way. Jolene did not intend to see Elaine lost to the tower, whatever she had done. Do no forget joining with the rebels. Light, Teslin. They were probably scooped up just like the girls the rebels took out of the tower. Does it really matter a whit whether they begin mucking out stalls tomorrow or next year? That was surely as much as the novices and accepted with the rebels would have to face. Even the Ajahs can wait to have them in hand, really. It is not as if they aren't safe. They are accepted, after all, and they certainly seem content to stay where we can reach them whenever we choose. I say let us sit where Elida put us and continue to fold our hands and hold our tongues, until she asks nicely to find out what we are doing. She did not say that she was prepared to wait until Elida found herself deposed as Swan had been. The hall surely would not put up with the bullying and bungling forever, but Teslin was red, after all, and would not appreciate hearing that. I suppose there do be no urgency, Teslin said slowly, the unspoken but all but shouting itself. Drawing a ball-footed chair to the table with another flow of air, Jolene settled herself to convincing her companion that silence remained the best policy. Still a child, was she? If she had her way, Elida would not get so much as a word out of Ebudar until she begged for it. The woman on the table arched up as far as her bonds would allow, eyes bulging, throat corded with a piercing scream that went on and on. Abruptly, the scream was a loud, choking rasp instead, and she convulsed, shaking from wrists to ankles, then collapsed in silence. Wide-open eyes stared sightlessly at the cobwebbed basement ceiling. Giving vent to curses was irrational, but Fallien could have turned the air as blue as any stableman. Not for the first time she wished she had Tamila here instead of Ispan. Questions were answered eagerly for Tamila, and nobody died until she was ready. Of course, Tamila enjoyed the work entirely too much, but that was beside the point. Channeling once more, Fallien gathered the woman's clothes from the filthy floor and dropped them atop the body. The red leather belt fell off, and she snatched it up by hand and slapped it back onto the pile. Perhaps she should have used other methods, but straps and pincers and hot irons were so messy. Leave the body in an alley somewhere. Slit the throat so it looks as if she was robbed. You can keep the coins in her purse. The two men, squatting on their heels against the stone wall, exchanged looks. Arnin and Nad might have been brothers by their appearance, all black hair and beady eyes and scars, with more muscles than any three men could need, but they did have sufficient brains to carry out simple orders, usually. "Forgiveness, mistress," Arnin said hesitantly. "But no one will believe." "Do as you are told," she snapped, channeling to haul him to his feet and slam him back against the stones. His head bounced, yet that surely could do him no danger. Nad rushed to the table, babbling. "Yes, mistress, as you command, mistress." When she released Arnin, he did not babble, but he staggered over without any more objections to help gather up the body like so much rubbish and carry it out. Well, it was so much rubbish now. She regretted the outburst. Letting temper take control was irrational. It did seem to be effective at times, though. After all these years, that still surprised her. "Mogedion, she will not like this," Ispan said as soon as the men had gone. The blue and green beads that were worked into her many slim black braids clacked as she shook her head. She had remained in the shadows the whole time, in a corner, with a small ward woven so she could not hear. Fallien managed not to glare. Ispan was the last companion she would have chosen for herself. She was blue, or had been. Perhaps she still was. Fallien did not really think herself any less white Aja because she had joined the black. Blues were too fervent, tying emotion around what should be viewed with utter dispassion. Rihanna, another white, would have been her choice, though the woman did have odd, unsound notions on several points of logic. "Mogedion has forgotten us, Ispan, or have you received some private word from her? In any case, I am convinced this cache does not exist." "Mogedion, she says that it does," Ispan began firmly, but her voice quickly grew warm. "A store of Angrial and Sa'angrial and Turangrial. We will have some part of them. Angrial of our very own, Fallien. Perhaps even Sa'angrial. She has promised." Mogedion was wrong. Fallien watched shock widen the other woman's eyes. The chosen were only people. Learning that lesson had stunned Fallien, too, but some refused to learn. The chosen were vastly stronger, infinitely more knowledgeable, and quite possibly they had already received the reward of immortality, but by all evidence they schemed and fought each other as hard as two Murandians with one blanket. Ispan's shock quickly gave way to anger. "There are others looking. Would they all look for nothing? There are friends of the dark looking. They must have been sent by others of the chosen. If the chosen look, can you still say there is nothing?" She would not see. If a thing could not be found, the most obvious reason was that it was not there. Fallien waited. Ispan was not stupid, only awestruck, and Fallien did believe in making people teach themselves what they should already be aware of. Lazy minds needed to be exercised. Ispan paced, swishing her skirts and frowning at the dust and old cobwebs. "This place smells, and it is filthy." She shuddered as a large black cockroach went skittering up the wall. The glow surrounded her for a moment. A flow squashed the beetle with a popping sound. Making a face, Ispan wiped her hands on her skirts, as if she had used them instead of the power. She had a delicate stomach, though fortunately not when she could remove herself from the actual deed. "I will not report the failure to one of the chosen, Falian. She would make us envy Leandrin, yes?" Falian did not quite shiver. She did, however, cross the basement and pour herself a cup of plum punch. The plums had been old and the punch was too sweet, but her hands remained steady. Fear of Mogedion was perfectly sensible, but yielding to fear was not. Perhaps the woman was dead. Surely she would have summoned them by now else, or snatched them sleeping into Tel Irunriod again to tell her why they had not yet carried out her commands. Until she saw a body, though, the only logical choice was to continue as if Mogedion would appear any moment. There is a way. How? Put every wise woman in Ebu Dar to the question? How many are there? 100? 200, perhaps? The sisters in the Tarasin Palace, they would notice this, I think. Forget your dreams of owning a Sa'angreal, Ispan. There is no long, hidden storehouse, no secret basement beneath a palace. Falian spoke in cool, measured tones, perhaps more measured the more agitated Ispan became. She had always enjoyed mesmerizing a class of novices with the sound of her voice. Almost all of the wise women are wilders, highly unlikely to know what we wish to learn. No wilder has ever been found keeping an Angreal, much less a Sa'angreal, and they surely would have been found. On the contrary, by every record, a wilder who discovers any object ties to the power rids herself of it as soon as possible for fear of attracting the wrath of the White Tower. Women who are put out of the tower, on the other hand, seem not to have the same fear. As you well know, when they are searched before leaving, fully one in three has secreted something about her person, an actual object of the power or something she believes is one. Of the few wise women who qualified present, Callie was the perfect choice. When she was put out 4 years ago, she tried to steal a small Turangrial, a useless thing that makes images of flowers and the sound of a waterfall, but still an object tied to Sidar. And she tried to discover all the other novices' secrets, succeeding more often than not. If there was even a single Angreal in Ebu Dar, not to speak of a vast storehouse, do you think she could have been 4 years here without locating it? "I do wear the shawl, Falian," Ispan said with extraordinary asperity, "and I do know all of that as well as you. You said there was another way. What way?" She simply would not apply her brain. What would please Mogedion as greatly as the cash? Ispan simply stared at her, tapping her foot. "Nynaeve Almira, Ispan. Mogedion abandoned us to go chasing after her, but obviously she escaped somehow. If we give Nynaeve, and the Trakand girl for that matter, to Mogedion, she would forgive us 100 Sa'angreal." Which clearly demonstrated that the chosen could be irrational, of course. It was best, of course, to be extremely careful with those who were both irrational and more powerful than you. Ispan was not more powerful. "We should have killed her as I wanted when she first appeared," she spat. Waving her hands, she stalked up and down, grime crunching loudly beneath her slippers. "Yes, yes, I know. Our sisters in the palace, they might have become suspicious. We do not wish to draw their eyes. But have you forgotten Tanchico? And Tyr? Where those two girls appear, disaster follows. Me, I think if we cannot kill them, we should remain as far from Nynaeve Almira and Elaine Trakand as we can. As far as we can." "Calm yourself, Ispan. Calm yourself." If anything, Falian's soothing tone only seemed to agitate the other woman more. But Falian was confident. Logic must prevail over emotion.
Sitting on an upended barrel in the sparse coolness of a narrow shaded alley, he studied the house across the busy street. Suddenly he realized he was touching his head again. He did not have a headache, but his head felt peculiar sometimes. Most often when he thought of what he could not remember. 3 stories of white plaster, the house belonged to a goldsmith who supposedly was being visited by 2 friends she had met on a journey north some years ago. The friends had only been glimpsed on arrival and not seen since. Finding that out had been easy, Finding out they were Aes Sedai, only a trifle more difficult. A lean young man in a torn vest, whistling his way down the street with no good on his mind, paused when he glimpsed him sitting on the barrel. His coat and his location in the shadows, and the rest of him, he admitted ruefully, probably looked tempting. He reached under his coat. His hands no longer possessed the strength or flexibility for sword work, but the two long knives he had carried for well over 30 years had surprised more than one swordsman. Maybe something showed in his eyes, because the lean young man thought better of it and whistled his way on. Beside the house, the gate that led back to the goldsmith's stable swung open, and two burly men appeared, pushing a barrow piled high with soiled straw and muck. What were they up to? Arnon and Nad were hardly the lads to be mucking out the stables. He would stay here until dark, he decided, then see whether he could find Carradine's pretty little killer again. Once again he pulled his hand down from his head. Sooner or later, he would remember. He did not have much time left, but it was all he did have. He remembered that much. Chapter 18. The last chapter of Part 1. As the Plough Breaks the Earth. Seizing Sidene long enough to unknot the ward he had woven across one corner of the anteroom, Rand raised his small silver-mounted cup and said, "More tea." Luz Theron muttered angrily in the back of his head. Carved chairs, heavy with gilt, stood in paired lines to either side of a golden rising sun, 2 paces wide, set into the polished stone floor, and another tall chair so gilded it seemed entirely gold, topped a small dais that was just as elaborate. But he sat cross-legged on a carpet, spread for the occasion, green and gold and blue, in a Tyran maze. The 3 clan chiefs seated across from him would have disliked him receiving them from a chair, even if they were offered their own. They were another maze, to be trod on warily. He was in his shirt, sleeves pushed up his forearms to expose the red and gold dragon that curled around each, glittering metallically. The Aielman's cotton sore covered theirs, on the left arm alone. Perhaps the reminder of who he was, that he too had been to Roydion when the journey meant death for most men who entered. Perhaps it was unnecessary. Perhaps. Those 3 faces gave away little as they watched Marana come from the corner where she had been sealed off. Janwin's creased face could have been carved from old wood, but it always looked that way, and if his blue-gray eyes seemed stormy, so did they always, too. Even his hair looked like storm clouds. He was an even-tempered man, though. Indirian and one-eyed Mandalayne might have been thinking of something else, except that their unblinking gazes followed her. Luz Theron suddenly went silent, as if he too watched, through Rand's eyes. Mirana's ageless features revealed even less than the clan chief's. Smoothing her pale gray skirts under, she knelt beside Rand and lifted the teapot. A massive ball of gold-washed silver, with leopards for feet and handle, and another crouched on the lid, it required both of her hands, and wavered a little as she carefully filled Rand's cup. Her manner seemed to say she did this because she wanted to, for reasons of her own that none of them could begin to understand. Her manner seemed to say she did this because she wanted to, for reasons of her own that none of them could begin to understand. Her manner shouted Aes Sedai louder than her face did. Was that to the good or the bad? "I do not allow them to channel without permission," he said. The clan chiefs kept silent. Marana rose and moved to kneel beside each in turn. Mandalayne covered his cup with a broad hand to indicate he wanted no more. The other 2 held out theirs, blue-gray eyes and green alike, studying her. What did they see? What more could he do? Replacing the heavy teapot on the thick, leopard-handled tray, she remained on her knees.
"May I serve my Lord Dragon in any way else?"
Her voice was self-possession itself, but after he motioned her back to her corner, after she had risen and turned, slim hands clutched at her skirts for an instant. Yet that might have been because turning brought her to face Dashiva and Narishima. The 2 Ashaman, to be precise, Narishima was still only a soldier, the lowest level of Ashaman, with neither the sword nor the dragon on his collar, The Ashaman stood impassively between two of the tall, golden-framed mirrors that lined the walls. At least the younger man looked impassive, at first glance. Thumbs tucked behind his sword belt, he ignored Marana and paid little more attention to Rand or the Aielman. Yet at a second glance you saw that his dark, too big eyes never rested, as if he expected the unexpected to leap out of the air any moment. And who could say it would not? Dashiva appeared to have his head in the clouds, his lips moved soundlessly, and he blinked and frowned at nothing. Luce Theron snarled when Rand looked at the Ashaman, but it was Marana who occupied the dead man inside Rand's head.
"Only a fool thinks a lion or a woman can truly be tamed."
Irritably, Rand suppressed the voice to a muted buzz. Luce Theron could break through, but not without effort. Grabbing hold of Sidene, he rewove the ward that shut Marana away from their voices. Releasing the source again increased his irritation, the hissing in his head, the water drops on red coals. An echo pulsing in time with Luce Theron's mad, distant rage. Marana stood behind the barrier she could neither see nor feel, head high and hands folded at her waist, as if a shawl were looped over her arms. Aes Sedai to her toenails. She watched him and the clan chiefs with cool eyes, light brown, flecked with yellow. "My sisters do not all realize how very much we need you," she had told him this morning in this very room. "But all of us who swore will do whatever you ask, that would not violate the three oaths." He had just wakened when she came with Soralea escorting her. Neither seemed to care at all that he was still in a robe, with only one bite taken from his breakfast bread.
"I have more than a little skill in negotiation and mediation. My sisters have other skills. Let us serve you as we pledged. Let me serve you. We need you, but you have some need of us, too."
Ever present, Elana lay nestled in a corner of his brain. She was weeping again. He could not understand why she wept so often. He had forbidden her to come near him unless summoned, or leave a room without an escort of maidens. The sisters who had sworn to him had been found rooms last night, in the palace where he could keep an eye on them. But he had sensed tears from the moment she bonded him. Tears, and a raw grief, like being ripped by claws. Sometimes it was less, sometimes more. Yet always there. Elana also had told him he needed the sworn sisters, screamed it at him finally, with her face red and tears rolling down her cheeks, before literally running from his presence. And she had spoken of serving too, though he doubted that Marana's present tasks were what either had in mind. Perhaps some sort of livery would make it clear? The clan chiefs watched Marana watch them, not so much as the flicker of an eyelash betrayed their thoughts. "The wise ones have told you where the Aes Sedai stand," Rand said bluntly. Soralea had told him they knew, but the fact would have been clear from the lack of surprise when they first saw Marana fetch and curtsy. "You've seen her bring the tray and pour your tea. You've seen her come and go as I say. If you want, I'll have her dance a jig." Convincing the Aiel that he was not on the end of an Aes Sedai leash was the most needed service any of the sisters could do him right now. He would have them all doing jigs if necessary. Mandalayne adjusted the gray-green patch over his right eye, the way he did when he wanted a moment to think. A thick, puckered scar ran up his forehead from behind the leather patch, and halfway across his mostly bald head. When he finally spoke, it was only a little less blunt than Rand. "Some say an Aes Sedai will do anything to have what she wants." Indirian lowered heavy white brows and peered down his long nose at his tea. Of only average height for an Aielman, he was shorter than Rand by half a hand, yet everything about him seemed long. The heat of the waist appeared to have melted away every spare ounce of flesh, and a few more besides. His cheekbones stood out sharp, and his eyes were emeralds set in caves.
"I do not like speaking of Aes Sedai."
His deep, rich voice was always a shock, coming from that gaunt face.
"What is done is done. Let the wise ones deal with them."
"Better to speak of the Shido dogs," Janwin said mildly.
which was almost as great a shock coming from his fierce face. Within a few months, less than half a year at most, every Shido who can be will be dead or made Gaishin. Just because his voice was soft did not mean he was. The other two nodded. Mandalayne smiled eagerly. They still seemed unconvinced. The Shido had been the professed reason for this meeting, and no less important for not being the most important. Not unimportant, the Shido had made trouble long enough, just not on the same page with the Aes Sedai in his book. They did present problems, though. Three clans joining Timelin's Mia Goma, already near Kinslayer's Dagger, might well be able to do as Janwin said, but there were those who could not be made Gaishin and could not be killed. Some were more critical than others. "What of the wise ones?" he asked. For a moment their faces became unreadable. Not even Aes Sedai could do that so well as Aiel. Facing the One Power did not frighten them, not where it showed, at least. No one could outrun death, so Aiel believed, and 100 Aes Sedai in a rage could not make alone Aiel lower the veil once raised. But learning that wise ones had taken part in the fighting at Dumai's Wells had hit them like watching the sun rise by night and the moon by day in a blood-red sky.
"Sarinda tells me almost all of the wise ones will run with the Algaid Siswai,"
Indirian said at last, reluctantly. Sarinda was the wise one who had followed him from Red Springs, clan hold of the Kodara. Or perhaps "followed" was not the right word. Wise ones seldom did. In any case, most of the Kodara wise ones, and the Shianda, and the Darain, would go north with the spears.
"The Shido wise ones will be dealt with by wise ones."
His mouth twisted with disgust.
"All things change."
Jenwin's voice was even softer than usual. He believed, but he did not want to. Wise ones taking part in battle violated custom as old as the Aiel. Mandalayne set his cup down with exaggerated care.
"Corahwin wishes to see Jer again before the dream ends, and so do I."
Like Bale and Ruark, he had two wives. The other chiefs had only one each, except Timelin. But a widowed chief seldom remained so long. The wise one saw to that if he did not. "Will any of us ever see the sun rise again in the threefold land?"
"I hope so," Rand said slowly. "As the plow breaks the earth, shall he break the lives of men, and all that was shall be consumed in the fire of his eyes. The trumpets of war shall sound at his footsteps, the ravens feed at his voice, and he shall wear a crown of swords."
The prophecies of the dragon gave little hope for anything except victory over the Dark One, and only a chance of that. The prophecy of Roedion, the Aiel prophecy, said he would destroy them. The bleakness swept through the clans because of him, and ancient customs were ripped apart. Even without the Aes Sedai, small wonder if some chiefs pondered whether they were right to follow Randall Thor, dragons on his arms or no.
"I hope so."
"May you always find water and shade, Randall Thor," Indirian said.
After they left, Rand sat frowning into his cup, finding no answers in the dark tea. Finally, he set it beside the tray and pushed his sleeves down. Mirana's eyes were intent on him, as if trying to pull out his thoughts. There was a hint of impatience about her, too. He had told her to stay in the corner unless she could hear voices. Doubtless, she saw no reason why she should not come out, now the clan chiefs were gone. Come out and dig out what had been said.
"Do you think they believe I dance on Aes Sedai strings?" he said.
Young Narishima gave a start. In truth, he was a little older than Rand, but he had the look of a boy 5 or 6 years younger. He glanced at Mirana, as though she had the answer, and shifted his shoulders uncomfortably.
"I do not know, my lord dragon."
Dashiva blinked and stopped murmuring to himself. Tilting his head, bird-like, he eyed Rand sideways.
"Does it matter, so long as they obey?"
"It matters," Rand said. Dashiva shrugged, and Narishima frowned thoughtfully.
Neither seemed to understand, yet maybe Narishima could come to. Maps littered the stone floor behind the throne on its dais, rolled or folded or spread out where he had left them. He shifted some with the toe of his boot. So much to be juggled at once. Northern Kyrian and the mountains called Kinslayer's Dagger, and the region around the city. Ilion and the plains of Moredo out to Farmatting. The island of Tarvalen and all the surrounding towns and villages. Gildan and part of Amadisia. Movement and color in his head. Luz Theron moaned and laughed in the distance. Faint, mad mutters of killing the Ashaman, killing the Forsaken. Killing himself. Alana stopped weeping, cutting anguish subdued beneath a thin thread of anger. Rand scrubbed his hands through his hair, pressing hard against his temples. What had it been like to be alone inside his own skull? He could not recall. One of the tall doors opened to admit one of the maidens who were standing guard in the corridor. Rylan, with vivid yellow-red hair and a grin for everything, actually managed to appear plump. For a maiden, anyway. Berylaine Sir Payendrag and Anura Larison wish to see the Karakarn, she announced. Her voice went from warm and friendly on the first name to cold and flat on the second without disturbing her grin. Rand sighed and opened his mouth to let them enter, but Berylaine did not wait. She stormed in, a somewhat calmer Anura at her heels. The Aes Sedai shied slightly at the sight of Dashiva and Narishima, and stared curiously when she saw Mirana standing in her corner. Not so Berylaine.
"What is the meaning of this, my Lord Dragon?"
she demanded, brandishing the letter he had delivered to her this morning. She stalked across the floor to shake it under his nose.
"Why am I to return to Mayenne? I have governed well here in your name, and you know it. I could not stop Kolover having herself crowned, but at least I stopped her changing the laws you made. Why am I to be sent away? And why am I told by letter, not to my face? By letter! Thanked for my services and dismissed like a clerk who's done collecting the taxes!"
Even furious, the first of Mayenne was one of the most beautiful women Rand had ever seen. Black hair fell in shining waves to her shoulders, framing a face to make a blind man stare. A man could easily drown in her dark eyes. Today she wore shimmering silver silk, thin and clinging, and more suited to entertaining a lover in private. In fact, had the neckline been a hair lower, she would not have been able to wear the dress in public. As it was, he was not sure she should. He had told himself, when writing that letter, that it was because he had too much to do and no time for arguing with her. The truth was, he enjoyed looking at her too much. For some reason, he had begun feeling that that was not exactly wrong, but almost. As soon as she appeared, Luz Theron gave over ranting to hum softly, the way he did when admiring a woman. Abruptly, Rand realized he was thumbing his earlobe and felt a shock. Instinctively, he knew that was something else Luz Theron did without thinking, like the humming. He pushed his hand to his side, but for an instant it wanted to rise to his ear again.
"Burn you, this is my body,"
the thought was a snarl.
"Mine!"
Luz Theron's hum stopped in surprise and confusion. Without a sound, the dead man fled, back into the deepest shadows of Rand's brain. Rand's silence had an effect. Berylaine lowered the letter, and her anger receded. A little. Eyes fixed on his, she drew a deep breath that heated his cheeks.
"My Lord Dragon."
"You know why," he cut in. Looking only at her eyes was not easy. Oddly, he found himself wishing Min were there. Very odd. Her viewings would be no help now. "When you returned from that seafolk ship this morning, there was a fellow waiting on the dock with a knife." Berylaine tossed her head contemptuously.
"He came no closer than 3 steps. I was accompanied by 12 of the winged guards and Lord Captain Gallienne."
Nirella had led some of the winged guards to Demise Wells, but Gallienne commanded the guards as a whole. She had 800 of them in the city, aside from those who returned with Nirella.
"You expect me to turn tail because of a cut-purse?"
"Don't play the fool," he growled. "A cut-purse with 12 soldiers around you?"
Color flared in her cheeks. She knew all right. He gave her no chance for protests or explanations or any other foolishness. Dobrain tells me he's already heard whispers in the palace that you betrayed Kolaver. Those who supported her might be afraid to say boo to me, but they'll pay to have a knife stuck into you. And Fael, too, according to Dobrain. That was being taken care of. But they won't have a chance, because you are going back to Mayenne. Dobrain will take your place here until Elaine claims the Sun Throne. She spluttered as if he had dumped cold water down her dress. Her eyes grew dangerously large. He had been glad when she stopped being afraid of him, but now he was not so sure. As she opened her mouth to explode, Anura touched her arm, and her head whipped around. They exchanged a long look, and Berylaine's sputters subsided. She smoothed her skirts and vigorously squared her shoulders. Rand looked away hastily. Marana hovered at the edge of the ward. He wondered whether she had stepped across and dodged back. How else could she stand right on top of what she could not possibly detect? When his head turned, she moved backward until she almost touched the walls, her eyes never leaving him. By her face, she would have poured his tea every day for 10 years to hear what was being said.
"My lord dragon," Berylaine said, smiling, "there is still the matter of the Athan Mier."
Her voice was warm honey. The curve of her lips would have sparked thoughts of kisses in a stone.
"The wave Mistress Harine is not pleased to be left sitting on her ship so long. I have visited with her a number of times. I can smooth the difficulties there, which I hardly think Lord Dobrain can. I believe the sea folk are vital to you, whether or not the prophecies of the dragon mention them. You are crucial in their prophecies, though they seem reluctant to say exactly how."
Rand stared. Why was she struggling so hard to keep a difficult job that had offered few thanks from Kyrianen, even before some began wanting to kill her? She was a ruler, used to dealing with rulers and embassies, not street thugs and knives in the dark. Warm honey or no warm honey, it was not for any desire to stay near Randall Thor. She had, well, offered herself to him, once. But the hard fact was that Mayenne was a small country, and Berylaine used her beauty as a man would a sword, to keep her land from being swallowed by its more powerful neighbor, Tyr. And there, simple as that, he had it. "Berylaine, I don't know what else I can do to guarantee Mayenne for you, but I will write out any—" Colors swirled so strongly in his head that his tongue froze. Luz Theron cackled. "A woman who knows the danger and isn't afraid is a treasure only a madman would spurn."
"Guarantees."
Bleakness engulfed honey, and anger bubbled again, cold this time. Anura plucked at Berylaine's sleeve, but she paid the Aes Sedai no heed.
"While I sit in Mayenne with your guarantees, others will serve you. They will ask their rewards, and the service I did here will be faded and old, while theirs is bright and new. If the High Lord Wyroman gives you Ilion and asks Mayenne in return, what will you say? If he gives you Murindi and Altara and everything clear to the Arith Ocean—"
"Will you serve, if it still means leaving?" he asked quietly. "You will be out of my sight, but not out of my mind." Luz Theron laughed again, in such a way that Rand nearly blushed. He enjoyed looking, but sometimes the things Luz Theron thought. Berylaine considered him with stubborn eyes, and he could all but see the questions being toted up behind Anura's, the careful choosing of which to ask. The door opened again for Rylan.
"An Aes Sedai has come to see the Karakhan."
She managed to sound cold and uncertain at the same time.
"Her name is Cadsuane Maladrin."
A strikingly handsome woman swept in right behind her, iron gray hair gathered in a bun atop her head and decorated with dangling gold ornaments, and it seemed everything happened at once.
"I thought you were dead,"
Anura gasped, eyes nearly starting out of her head. Mirana darted through the ward, hands outstretched.
"No, Cadsuane," she screamed. "You mustn't harm him. You must not."
Rand's skin tingled as someone in the room embraced Saidar, perhaps more than one, and swiftly moving well clear of Berylaine, He seized hold of the source, flooding himself with Zayadeen, feeling it fill the Ashaman. Dashiva's face twitched as he glared from one Aes Sedai to another. Despite the power he held, Narishima grasped his sword hilt with both hands and assumed the stance called Leopard in the Tree, on the brink of drawing. Luz Theron snarled of killing and death. Kill them all. Kill them now. Rylan raised her veil, shouting something, and suddenly a dozen maidens were in the room, veiling, spears ready. It was hardly surprising that Berylaine stood gaping as if everyone had gone mad. For someone who had caused all that, this Cadswain seemed remarkably unaffected. She looked at the maidens and shook her head, golden stars and moons and birds swaying gently.
"Trying to grow decent roses in northern Gildan may be near to death, Anura," she said dryly, "but it is not quite the grave. Oh, do calm down, Mirana, before you frighten someone. One would think you would have grown a little less excitable since putting off Novice White."
Mirana opened and closed her mouth, looking abashed of all things, and the tingling vanished abruptly. Rand did not release Sayadeen, though, nor did the Ashaman.
"Who are you?" he demanded. "What Aja?"
Red by Mirana's reaction, but for a Red Sister simply to walk in like this, alone, would require suicidal courage.
"What do you want?"
Cadswain's gaze lingered on him for no more than a moment, and she did not answer. Mirana's lips parted, but the gray-haired woman looked at her, raising one eyebrow, and that was that. Mirana actually reddened and lowered her eyes. Anura was still staring at the newcomer as if at a ghost, or a giant. Without a word, Cadswain swept across the room to the two Ashaman, dark green divided skirts swishing. Rand was beginning to get the feeling that she always moved in that rushing glide, graceful yet wasting no time, and allowing nothing to impede her. Dashiva stared her up and down and sneered. Although looking him straight in the face, she did not seem to notice, any more than she appeared to notice Narishima's hands on his sword when she put a finger under his chin, moving his head from side to side before he could jerk back.
"What lovely eyes," she murmured.
Narishima blinked uncertainly, and Dashiva's sneer turned to a grin, but a nasty one that made his former smirk light-hearted in comparison.
"Do nothing," Rand snapped.
Dashiva had the gall to glower at him before sullenly pressing a fist to his chest in the salute the Ashaman used.
"What do you want here, Cadswain?" Rand went on. "Look at me, burn you!"
She did, turning just her head.
"So you are Randall Thor, the Dragon Reborn. I'd have thought even a child like Moraine could have taught you a few manners."
Rylan put the spear from her right hand with those clutched behind her buckler and flashed maiden hand talk. For once, none laughed. For once, Rand was sure the talk was not a joke about him. "Be easy, Rylan," he said, raising a hand. "All of you be easy." Cadswain ignored the byplay, too, directing a smile to Berylaine.
"So this is your Berylaine, Anura.
She is more beautiful than I had heard." The curtsy she made, bowing her head, was quite deep, yet somehow without any suggestion of obeisance, no hint that she was in any way less. It truly was a curtsy, no more.
"My Lady First of Mayenne, I must speak with this young man, and I would retain your adviser. I've heard you've undertaken many duties here. I would not keep you from them."
It was as clear a dismissal as could be, short of holding the door open. Berylaine inclined her head graciously, then smoothly turned to Rand and spread her skirts in a curtsy so deep that he worried whether she would remain even as clothed as she was.
"My Lord Dragon," she intoned, "I ask your kind permission to withdraw."
Rand's return bow was not so practiced.
"Granted, my lady first, as you wish."
He offered her a hand to help her rise. "I hope you will consider my proposal."
"My lord dragon, I will serve you wherever and however you desire."
Her voice was all honey again. For Cadswain's benefit, he supposed. There was certainly no flirtation on her voice, only determination.
Remember, Harine, she added in a whisper.
When the door closed behind Berylaine, Cadswain said, It's always good to see children play, don't you think, Mirana?
Mirana goggled, head swiveling between Rand and the gray-haired sister. Anura looked as though only willpower held her upright. Most of the maidens followed Berylaine, apparently deciding there was to be no killing, but Rylan and two others remained before the door, still veiled. It might have been coincidence that there was one for each Aes Sedai. Dashiva also seemed to think any danger passed. He leaned back against the wall with a foot propped, lips moving silently, arms folded, apparently watching the Aes Sedai. Narishima frowned questioningly at Rand, but Rand only shook his head. The woman was deliberately trying to provoke him. The question was, why provoke a man she must know could still her, or kill her, without exerting himself? Luce Theron muttered the same thing.
Why?
Stepping onto the dais, Rand took up the dragon scepter from the throne and sat, waiting to see what would happen. The woman was not going to succeed.
Rather ornate, wouldn't you say?
Cadswain said to Anura, looking around. Aside from all the other gold, broad bands of it ran around the walls above the mirrors, and the cornices were nearly 2 feet of golden scales.
I've never known whether Karayenin or Tyrans overdo worse. But either can make an Ebu Dari blush, or even a tinker. Is that a tea tray? I would like some if it's fresh and hot.
Channeling, Rand scooped up the tray, half expecting to see the metal corrode from the taint, and wafted it to the three women. Mirana had brought extra cups, and four still stood unused on the tray. He filled three, replaced the teapot, and waited. It floated in midair, supported by Saideen. Three very different women in appearance, and three distinctly different reactions. Three very different women in appearance, and three distinctly different reactions. Anura looked at the tray much as one might a coiled viper, gave a tiny shake of her head, and took a small step back. Mirana drew a deep breath and slowly picked up a cup with a hand that trembled slightly. Knowing a man could channel and being forced to see it were not at all the same. Cadswain, though, took her cup and sniffed the vapors with a pleased smile. Nothing could tell her which of the three men had poured the tea, yet she looked across her cup straight at Rand, lounging with one leg over the arm of his chair.
"That's a good boy," she said.
The maidens passed shocked looks over their veils. Rand quivered. No, she would not provoke him. For whatever reason, that was what she wanted, and she would not. "I will ask one more time," he said. Strange that his voice could be that cold. Instead, he was hotter than the hottest fires of Saideen. "What do you want? Answer or leave. By the door or a window. Your choice." Again Mirana began to speak, and again Cadswain silenced her, this time by a sharp gesture, without looking away from him.
"To see you," she said calmly. "I am green, Alja, not red, but I have worn the shawl longer than any other sister living, and I have faced more men who could channel than any four reds, maybe than any 10. Not that I hunted them, you understand, but I seem to have a nose."
Calmly, a woman saying she had been to market once or twice in her life.
"Some fought to the bitter end, kicking and screaming even after they were shielded and bound. Some wept and begged, offering gold, anything, their very souls not to be taken to Tarvalin. Still others wept from relief, meek as lambs, thankful finally to be done with it. Light's truth, they all weep at the end. There is nothing left for them but tears at the end."
The heat inside him erupted in a rage. Tray and massive teapot hurtled across the room, smashing a mirror with a thunderous crash and bouncing back in a shower of glass. Half-flattened pot spraying tea, tray spinning across the floor bent double. Everyone jumped except Cadswain. Rand leaped from the dais, clutching the dragon scepter so hard his knuckles hurt. "Is that supposed to frighten me?" he growled. "Do you expect me to beg or to be thankful, to weep? Aes Sedai, I could close my hand and crush you!"
The hand he held up shook with fury. Marana knows why I should. The light only knows why I don't. The woman looked at the battered tea things as if she had all the time in the world.
Now you know, she said at last, calm as ever, that I know your future and your present. The light's mercy fades to nothing for a man who can channel. Some see that and believe the light denies those men. I do not. Have you begun to hear voices yet?
What do you mean? He asked slowly. He could feel Luz Theron listening. The tingle returned to his skin, and he very nearly channeled, but all that happened was that the teapot rose and floated to Cadsuane, turning slowly in the air for her to examine.
Some men who can channel begin to hear voices.
She spoke almost absently, frowning at the flattened sphere of silver and gold.
It is a part of the madness. Voices conversing with them, telling them what to do.
The teapot drifted gently to the floor by her feet.
Have you heard any?
Startlingly, Dashiva gave a raucous laugh, shoulders shaking. Narishima wet his lips. He might not have been afraid of the woman before, but now he watched her closely as a scorpion. I will ask the questions, Bran said firmly. You seem to forget. I am the Dragon Reborn.
You are real, aren't you?
He wondered. There was no answer.
Luz Theron?
Sometimes the man did not answer, but Aes Sedai always drew him.
Luz Theron?
He was not mad. The voice was real, not imagination.
Not madness.
A sudden desire to laugh did not help. Cadsuane sighed.
You are a young man who has little idea where he is going or why or what lies ahead. You seem overwrought. Perhaps we can speak when you are more settled. Have you any objection to my taking Marana and Honora away for a little while? I've seen neither in quite some time.
Rand gaped at her. She swooped in, insulted him, threatened him, casually announced she knew about the voice in his head, and with that she wanted to leave and talk with Marana and Honora.
Is she mad?
Still no answer from Luz Theron. The man was real. He was.
Go away, he said. Go away and...
He was not mad.
All of you, get out! Get out!
Dashiva blinked at him, tilting his head, then shrugged and started for the door. Cadsuane smiled in such a way that he half expected her to tell him again he was a good boy, then gathered up Marana and Honora and herded them toward the maidens, who were lowering their veils and frowning worriedly. Narishima looked at him too, hesitating until Rand gestured sharply. Finally, they were all gone, and he was alone. Alone. Convulsively, he hurled the dragon scepter. The spear point stuck quivering in the back of one of the chairs, the tassels swaying.
I am not mad, he said to the empty room.
Luz Theron had told him things. He would never have escaped Galena's chest without the dead man's voice. But he had used the power before he ever heard the voice. He had figured out how to call lightning and hurl fire and form a construct that had killed hundreds of Trollocs. But then, maybe that had been Luz Theron, like those memories of climbing trees in a plum orchard, and entering the Hall of the Servants, and a dozen more that crept up on him unawares. And maybe those memories were all fancies, mad dreams of a mad mind, just like the voice. He realized he was pacing and could not stop. He felt as if he had to move or his muscles would tear him apart in spasms.
I am not mad, he panted.
Not yet.
I am not...
The sound of the door opening made him whirl, hoping for men. It was Rylan again, supporting a short, stocky woman in a dark blue dress, with hair more gray than not and a blunt face. A haggard, red-eyed face. He wanted to tell them to go away, to leave him alone. Alone. Was he alone? Was Luz Theron a dream? If only they would leave him... Adrian Tarson was the head of the school he had founded here in Kyrian. A woman so practical, he was not sure she believed in the One Power, since she could neither see nor touch it. What could reduce her to this state? He made himself turn toward her. Mad or not, alone or not, there was no one else to do what had to be done. Not even this small duty. Heavier than a mountain. "What is the matter?" he asked, making his voice as gentle as he could. Suddenly weeping, Idrian stumbled to him and collapsed against his chest. When she was coherent enough to tell her story, he felt like weeping too.
Chapter 19. Diamonds and Stars. Mirana followed closely as she dared on Cadsuane's heels, 100 questions bubbling on her tongue. But Cadsuane was not a woman whose sleeve you plucked. She decided who she noticed and when. Anura held her silence, too, the pair of them drawn along in the other's wake down the palace corridors, down flights of stairs, polished marble at first, then plain dark stone. Mirana exchanged glances with her sister Grey and felt a moment's pang. She did not know the woman, really, but Anura wore the steely look of a girl on her way to the mistress of novices, determined to be brave. They were not novices. They were not children. She opened her mouth and closed it, intimidated by the gray bun bobbing ahead of her, with its dangling moons and stars and birds and fish. Cadsuane was... Cadsuane. Mirana had met her once before, or at least listened to her and been spoken to when she was a novice. Sisters had come from every Aja to see the woman, filled with an awe they could not hide. Once Cadsuane Melaidrin had been the standard by which every new entry into the novice books was judged. Until Elaine Trakand, none had come to the White Tower in her lifetime who could match that standard, much less surpass it. In more ways than one, her like had not walked among Aes Sedai for 1,000 years. A refusal to accept selection as a sitter was unheard of, yet it was said she had refused, and at least twice. It was said she had spurned being raised head of the Green Aja, too. It was said she once vanished from the tower for 10 years because the hall intended to raise her Amerlin. Not that she had ever spent a day more in Tar Valon than absolutely necessary. Word of Cadsuane came to the tower, stories to make sisters gape, adventures to make those who dreamed of the shawl shiver. She would end a legend among Aes Sedai, if she was not already. The shawl had graced Mirana's shoulders for over 25 years when Cadsuane announced her retirement from the world, her hair already solid gray, and everyone assumed her long dead when the Aiel War erupted another 25 years on. But before the fighting was 3 months old, she reappeared, accompanied by 2 warders, men long in the tooth, yet still hard as iron. It was said Cadsuane had had more warders over the years than most sisters had shoes. After the Aiel retreated from Tar Valon, she retired once more, but some said, more than half seriously, that Cadsuane would never die so long as even a spark of adventure remained in the world. "And that is the sort of nonsense that novices babble," Mirana reminded herself firmly. "Even we die eventually." Yet Cadsuane was still Cadsuane. And if she was not one of those sisters who had appeared in the city after Althor was taken, the sun would not set tonight. Mirana moved her arms to adjust her shawl and realized it was hanging on a peg in her room. Ridiculous. She needed no reminders of who she was. If only it had been someone other than Cadsuane. A pair of wise ones standing in the mouth of a crossing corridor watched them pass, cold pale eyes in stony faces beneath their dark headscarves. Edara and Lane. Both could channel, and quite strongly. They might have risen high had they gone to the tower as girls. Cadsuane went by without seeming to notice the Wilder's disapprobation. Anura did, frowning and muttering, slender braids swaying as she shook her head. Mirana kept her own eyes on the floor tiles. Undoubtedly it would fall to her now, explaining to Cadsuane the compromise that had been worked out with the wise ones last night, before she and the others were brought to the palace. Anura did not know, she was no part of it, and Mirana had small hope that Raffaella or Varen would appear, or anyone else she might somehow foist the duty onto. It was a compromise in a way, and perhaps the best that could be expected under the circumstances, yet she strongly questioned whether Cadsuane would see it so. She wished she did not have to be the one to convince her. Better to pour tea for those cursed men for a month. She wished she had not been so free with her tongue with young Althor. Knowing why he had made her serve tea was no balm for being sealed off from every advantage she might have gained from it. She would rather think she had been caught in some Taviran swirling of the pattern than believe that a young man's eyes, like polished blue-gray gems, had set her babbling from pure fright. But either way, she had handed all the advantage to him on a tray. She wished... wishing was for children. She had negotiated countless treaties, many of which had actually accomplished what was intended. She had ended 3 wars and stopped 2 dozen more before they began, faced kings and queens and generals and made them see reason. Even so, she found herself promising that she would not utter 1 word of complaint, no matter how often that man made her play the maidservant, if only Sionid would pop around the next corner, or Masuri, or Faeldrin, or anyone at all. Light! If only she could blink her eyes and find that everything since leaving Salidar had been a bad dream. Surprisingly, Cadsawain led them straight to the small room that Bera and Kiruna shared, deep in the bowels of the palace, where the servants lived. A tight window set high in the wall, yet level with the paving stones of a courtyard outside, let in a little stream of light, but the room seemed murky. Cloaks and saddlebags and a few dresses hung from pegs in the cracked, yellowing plaster walls. Gouges marred the bare wooden floor, though some effort had been made to smooth them. A tiny, battered round table stood in one corner, and an equally beaten washstand in another, with a chipped basin and pitcher. Mirana eyed the small bed. It did not look that much narrower than the one she was forced to share with Sionid and Masuri, 2 doors farther down. That room was larger by perhaps a pace each way, but not meant for 3. Coiran and the others still held in the Aiel tents probably were much more comfortable as prisoners. Neither Bera nor Kiruna was present, but Daigian was, a plump, pale woman who wore a thin silver chain in her long black hair, with a round moonstone dangling in the middle of her forehead. Her dark Kyrianin dress bore 4 thin stripes of color across the bodice, and she had added slashes in the skirts, white, for her Aja. A younger daughter of one of the lesser houses, she had always minded Mirana of a pouter pigeon. When Cadsawain entered, Daigian rose on her toes expectantly. There was only 1 chair in the room, little more than a stool with an excuse of a back. Cadsawain took that and sighed. "Tea, please. 2 sips of what that boy poured, and I could have used my tongue to sole a shoe." The glow of Saidar immediately surrounded Daigian, though faintly, and a dented tin teapot rose from the table, flows of fire heating the water as she opened a small brass-bound tea-chest. With no other choice for place to sit, Mirana settled onto the bed, adjusting her skirts and shifting on the lumpy mattress while she tried to order her thoughts. This might well be as important a negotiation as she had ever undertaken. After a moment, Anura joined her, perching on the lip of the mattress. "I take it by your presence, Mirana," Cadsawain said abruptly, "that tales of the boys submitting to Elida are false. Don't look so surprised, child. Did you think I didn't know your... associations?" She gave that word such a twist it sounded as filthy as any soldier's expletive. "And you, Anura?" "I am here only to advise Berylaine, though the truth of it is... she ignored my advice by coming in the first place." The Tarabonar woman held her head up, voice confident. She was rubbing her thumbs for all she was worth, though. She could not do well at the negotiating table if she was that transparent. "For the rest," she said carefully, "I have reached no decision as yet." "A wise decision, that," Cadsawain murmured, with a pointed look at Mirana. "It seems that in the last few years far too many sisters have forgotten they possess brains, or discretion. There was a time when Aes Sedai reached their decisions after calm deliberation, with the good of the tower always in the front of their thoughts. Just remember what the Sanche girl got from meddling with Althor, Anura. Walk too near a forge fire and you can be burned badly." Mirana lifted her chin, working her neck to ease its tightness. Realizing what she was doing, she made herself stop. The woman did not stand that far above her. Not really. Just higher than any other sister. If I may ask, too diffident, but worse to stop and start over. What are your intentions, Cadswain? She struggled to maintain dignity. Obviously you have been holding yourself aside until now. Why have you decided to approach Althor at this particular time? You were rather undiplomatic with him. You might as well have slapped his face, Anura put in, and Marana colored. Of the two of them, Anura should have been having the harder time with Cadswain by far, but she was not the one stumbling over her words. Cadswain shook her head in pitying style. If you want to see what a man is made of, push him from a direction he doesn't expect. There's good metal in that boy, I think, but he's going to be difficult. Steepling her fingers, she peered across them at the wall, musing to herself. He has a rage in him fit to burn the world, and he holds it by a hair. Push him too far off balance? Faw! Althor's not so hard yet as Loghain Ablar or Mazrim Taim, but 100 times as difficult, I fear. Hearing those 3 names together clove Marana's tongue to the roof of her mouth. You have seen Loghain and Taim both? A staring Anura said. Taim, he is following Althor, so I hear. Marana managed to swallow a relieved sigh. Tales of Dumai's wells had not had time to spread yet. They would, though. I do have ears to catch rumors, too, Anura, Cadswain said acerbically. Though I could wish I didn't, for what I hear of that pair. All my work thrown away to be done over. Others as well, but I did my share. And then there are these black coats, these Ashaman. Taking a cup from Daigyan, she smiled warmly and murmured thanks. The round-cheeked white seemed ready to curtsy, though all she did was retreat to a corner and fold her hands. She had been longer a novice and accepted than anyone in living memory, barely allowed to remain in the tower, gaining the ring by a fingernail and the shawl by an eyelash. Daigyan was always self-effacing around other sisters. Breathing the steam from her teacup, Cadswain went on, suddenly chatting pleasantly. It was Loghain, practically on my doorstep, that lured me away from my roses. Faw! A scuffle at a sheep fair could have lured me from those light cursed plants. What's the point if you use the power, but do it without and you grow 10,000 thorns for every... Faw! I actually considered taking the oath as a hunter, if the Council of Nine would allow it. Well, it was a nice few months, chasing down Loghain, but once he was taken, escorting him to Tarvalin appealed as much as the roses. I wandered a bit to see what I could find, perhaps a new warder, though it's a bit late for that in any fairness to the man, I suppose. Then I heard of Taim, and I was off to Saldaia as fast as I could ride. There's nothing for a bit of excitement like a man who can channel. Abruptly her voice hardened, and her gaze. Were either of you involved in that vileness right after the Aiel War? Despite herself, Marana gave a confused start. The other woman's eyes spoke of the block and the headsman's axe. What vileness? I don't know what you were talking about. That accusing glare hit Anura so hard she almost fell off the bed. The Aiel War? She gasped, steadying herself. The years after I spent trying to make the so-called Grand Coalition more than a name. Marana looked at Anura with interest. A good many of the Grey Aja had scurried from capital to capital after the war in a futile effort to hold together the alliance that had formed against the Aiel, but she had never known Anura was one of them. She could not be that bad a negotiator if she was. So did I, she said. Dignity. Since setting out after Althor from Camelin, she had not retained much of that. The few scraps remaining were too precious to lose. She made her voice calm and firm. What vileness do you mean, Cadswain? The grey-haired woman simply waved the question away as though she had never spoken the word. For a moment, Marana wondered whether Cadswain's wits might be wandering. She had never heard of it happening to a sister, but most Aes Sedai did go into retreat at the close of their lives, far from the stratagems and turbulence that none but sisters ever knew. Far from everyone, often as not. Who could say what befell them before the end? One look at the clear, steady gaze regarding her over that teacup quickly disabused her of any such notion. Anyway, 20-year-old vileness, whatever it had been, certainly could not hold a candle to what the world confronted now. And Cadswain still had not answered her original questions. What did she intend? And why now? Before Marana could ask again, the door opened and Bera and Kiruna were herded in by Kuril Hovian, a boyishly slim yellow with thick black eyebrows and a mass of raven hair that gave her something of a wild appearance, no matter how neatly she dressed. And she always dressed for a country dance, with masses of embroidery on her sleeves and bodice and up the sides of her skirts. There was barely room to move with so many people in this confined space. Coriel never failed to seem amused, whatever happened, but now she wore a wide smile somewhere between disbelief and outright laughter. Kiruna's eyes flashed in a face of frozen arrogance, while Bera fumed, mouth tight and forehead creased, until they saw Cadswain. Marana supposed that for them it must be as if she had found herself face to face with Alin Daifela, or Sevlana Maso, or even Mabriam Enshereed. Their eyes bulged. Kiruna's jaw dropped. "I thought you were dead," Bera breathed. Cadswain sniffed irritably. "I'm growing tired of hearing that. The next imbecile I hear it from is going to yelp for a week." Anura began studying the toes of her slippers. "You'll never guess where I found these two," Coriel said in her lilting Murandian accent. She tapped the side of her upturned nose, the way she did when about to tell a joke, or what she saw as one. Spots of color appeared in Bera's cheeks, and larger in Kiruna's. "Bera there was sitting meek as a mouse under the eyes of half a dozen of those Aiel Wilders, who told me, bold as you please, that she couldn't come with me until Cerulea... Oh, now that woman's a harridan to give you nightmares, she is. I couldn't have Bera until Cerulea was done with her private chat with the other apprentice, our darling Kiruna there." It was no longer a matter of spots. Kiruna and Bera reddened to their hair, refusing to meet anyone's eye. Even Daigyan stared at them. Relief surged through Marana in wonderful waves. She would not have to be the one to explain how the Wise Ones had interpreted that wretched Althor's orders that the sisters were to obey them. They were not really apprentices. There were no lessons involved, of course. What could a great lot of Wilders, savages at that, teach Aes Sedai? It was just that the Wise Ones liked to know where everyone fit. Just? Bera or Kiruna could tell how Althor had laughed. Laughed! And said it made no difference to him, and he expected them to be obedient pupils. No one was having an easy time bending her neck, least of all Kiruna. Yet Cadswain did not demand explanations. "I expected a dog's dinner," she said dryly, "but not a bucket from the midden. Let me see if I have the straight of it. You children who stand in rebellion against a lawfully raised Amarlin have now somehow associated yourselves with the Althor boy, and if you are taking orders from these Aiel women, I assume you take his as well." Her grunt was disgusted enough for a mouthful of rotten plums. Shaking her head, she peered into her teacup, then fixed the pair again. "Well, what's one treason more or less? The Hall can put you on your knees from here to Tarmangaiden for penance, but they can only take your heads once. What of the rest, out in the Aiel camp? All Elidas, I suppose. Have they also apprenticed themselves? None of us have been allowed as close as the first row of tents. These Aiel seem to have no love of Aes Sedai." "I do not know, Cadswain," Kiruna answered, so red-faced she appeared about to catch fire. "We have been kept apart." Marana's eyes widened. She had never before heard Kiruna sound deferential. Bera, on the other hand, drew a deep breath. She already stood straight, yet she seemed to straighten herself for an unpleasant task. "Elida is not," she began heatedly. "Elida is overambitious, as near as I can make out," Cadswain broke in, leaning forward so abruptly that Marana and Anura both started back on the bed, though she was not looking at them. "And she may be a catastrophe simmering, but she is still the Amarlin seat raised by the Hall of the Tower in full accordance with the laws of the Tower." "If Elida is a lawful Amarlin, why have you not obeyed her order to return?" All that betrayed Bera's lack of composure was the stillness of her hands on her skirts. Only a marked effort to keep from clutching or smoothing could hold them so motionless. "So one of you has a little backbone." Cadswain laughed softly, but her eyes did not look mirthful at all. Leaning back, she sipped her tea. "Now sit down. I have a great many more questions." Mirana and Anura rose, offering their places on the bed, but Kiruna simply stood peering at Cadswain worriedly, and Bera glanced at her friend, then shook her head. Coriel rolled her blue eyes, grinning broadly for some reason, but Cadswain did not seem to care. "Half the rumors I hear," she said, "concern the Forsaken being loose. It would hardly be a surprise with all else, but do you have any evidence? For or against?" Before very long, Mirana was glad to be sitting. Before very long, she knew what Laundry felt, going through the laundress's mangle. Cadswain did all the questioning, dodging from topic to topic, so you never knew what was coming next. Coriel held her peace, except for chuckling now and then or shaking her head, and Daigyan did not even do that, of course. Mirana caught the worst, her and Bera and Kiruna, yet Anura was certainly not spared. Every time Beralane's advisor relaxed, thinking she was in the clear, Cadswain skewered her anew. The woman wanted to know everything, from the Althor boy's authority with the Aiel to why a sea-folk wave mistress was anchored in the river, from whether Moiraine truly was dead to whether the boy really had rediscovered traveling and whether Beralane had bedded him or had any intention of it. What Cadswain thought of the answers was impossible to say, except once, when she learned that Alanna had bonded Althor and how. Her mouth compressed to a thin line and she frowned a hole through the wall, but while everyone else expressed disgust, Mirana thought of Cadswain saying she had considered taking another warder herself. The answer was ignorance entirely too often to suit, but saying you did not know failed to quench Cadswain's appetite. She required every last shred and particle you did know, even if you did not know you knew it. They managed to keep a little back, most of what had to be kept back, yet a few surprising things came out that way, some very surprising, even from Anura, who it turned out had been receiving detailed letters from Beralane almost from the day the girl rode north. Cadswain demanded answers, but gave none, and that worried Mirana. She watched faces grow dogged and defensive and apologetic, and wondered whether her own looked the same. "Cadswain," she had to make one more effort. "Cadswain, why have you decided to take an interest in him now?" An unblinking gaze met hers for a moment, then Cadswain turned her attention to Bera and Kiruna. "So they actually managed to kidnap him right out of the palace," the gray-haired woman said, holding out her empty cup for Daigyan to refill. No one else had been offered tea. Cadswain's expression and tone were so neutral that Mirana wanted to tear her own hair. Althor would not be pleased if he learned Kiruna had revealed the kidnapping, however inadvertently. Cadswain used any slip of your tongue to pry out more than you meant to say. At least the details of his treatment had not come out. He had made plain how displeased he would be if that happened. Mirana thanked the light that the woman was not staying with any one subject for long. "You are sure it was Taim? And you are sure these black coats didn't arrive on horses?" Bera answered reluctantly, and Kiruna sullenly. They were as certain as they could be. No one had actually seen the Ashaman come or depart, and the hole that brought them all here could have been made by Althor, which did not satisfy at all, of course. "Think! You aren't silly girls any longer, or shouldn't be? Faugh! You must have noticed something!" Mirana felt ill. She and the others had spent half the night arguing over what their oath meant before deciding it meant exactly what they had said, with no loopholes to wriggle through. At last, even Kiruna conceded that they must defend and support Althor as well as obey, that standing aside in the slightest was not permitted. What that might mean when it came to Elida and the sisters loyal to her really concerned no one. At least, no one admitted any concern. The mere fact of what they had decided was stunner enough. But Mirana wondered whether Bera or Kiruna had yet realized what she had. They might just find themselves opposing a legend, not to mention whatever sisters besides Coriel and Daigyan had chosen to follow her. Worse. Cadswain's eyes rested on her for a moment, giving away nothing, demanding everything. Worse, Mirana was sure that Cadswain knew that very well. Hurrying along the palace corridors, Min ignored greetings from half a dozen maidens she knew, just trotted right by without a word in return, never considering that she was being rude. Trotting was not easy in heeled boots, the fool things women did for men. Not that Rand had asked her to wear the boots, but she put them on the first time with him in mind, and she had seen him smile. He liked them. Light, what was she doing thinking about boots? She should never have gone to Kola Vair's apartments. Shivering, blinking back unshed tears, she began to run. As usual, a number of maidens were squatting on their heels beside the tall doors worked with gilded rising suns. Their shufa hung about their shoulders, and their spears lay across their knees, yet there was nothing casual about them. They were leopards, waiting for something to kill. Usually maidens made men uneasy, for all they were friendly enough. Today she would not have cared if they were veiled. "He's in a foul temper," Rialin warned, but made no move to stop her. Min was one of the few allowed to enter Rand's presence without being announced. She straightened her coat and tried to settle herself. She was not sure why she had come, except that Rand made her feel safe. Burn him! She had never needed anyone to feel safe before. Just inside the room she stopped, aghast. Automatically she pushed the door shut behind her. The place was a shambles. A few glittering shards clung to some of the mirror frames, but most of the glass lay scattered across the floor. The dais was on its side, the throne that had stood atop it just gilded flinders where it had been smashed against a wall. One of the stand lamps, heavy iron beneath the gilt, had been twisted into a hoop. Rand sat in one of the smaller chairs in his shirt sleeves, arms dangling and head back, staring at the ceiling. Staring at nothing. Images danced about him and colored auras flickered and flared. He was like Aes Sedai in that. She had no need of illuminators when Rand or an Aes Sedai was in sight. He did not move as she walked farther into the room. He did not seem aware of her at all. Shattered bits of mirror crunched beneath her boots. A foul temper indeed. Even so, she felt no fear. Not of him. She could not begin to imagine Rand harming her. For him she felt enough to nearly purge the memory of Kola Vair's apartments from her head. She had long since reconciled herself to being hopelessly in love. Nothing else mattered, not that he was an unsophisticated countryman, younger than she, not who or what he was, not that he was doomed to go mad and die if he was not killed first. "I don't even mind having to share him," she thought, and knew how tightly she was caught if she could lie to herself. That she had forced herself to accept. Elaine had a part of him, a claim on him, and so did this Avienda woman she had yet to meet. What could not be mended must be lived with, so her Aunt Jan always said, especially when your brains had gone soft. Light, she'd always prided herself on keeping her wits. She stopped beside one of the chairs, where the dragon's scepter had driven into the thick wooden back so hard that the point stood out nearly a hand behind. In love with a man who did not know, who would send her away should he ever become aware. A man she was sure was in love with her, and with Elaine, and this Avienda, too. That she rushed by. What could not be mended? He was in love with her and refused to admit it. Did he think that just because Mad Luz Theron Telamon had killed the woman he loved, he was fated to as well?
"I'm glad you came," he said suddenly, still staring at the ceiling. "I've been sitting here alone." "Alone." He gave a bitter bark of a laugh. "Herod Fell is dead."
"No," she whispered. "Not that sweet little old man?" Her eyes stung.
"He was torn apart."
Rand's voice was so tired, so empty.
"Idrian fainted when she found him. She lay in a stupor half the night and was nearly incoherent when finally roused. One of the other women at the school gave her something to make her sleep. She was embarrassed about that. When she came to me, she started crying again, and it had to be Shadowspawn. What else could tear a man limb from limb?"
Without raising his head, he smacked a fist down on the chair arm so hard the wood creaked.
"But why? Why was he killed? What could he have told me?"
Min tried to think. She truly did. Master Fell was a philosopher. He and Rand discussed everything from the meaning of parts of the prophecies of the dragon to the nature of the hole into the Dark One's prison. He let her borrow books, fascinating books, especially where she had to work to puzzle out what it was they said. He had been a philosopher. He would never lend her a book again. Such a gentle old man, wrapped up in a world of thought and startled when he noticed anything outside it. She treasured a note he had written to Rand. He had said she was pretty, that she distracted him, and now he was dead. Light. She had had too much of death. I shouldn't have told you. Not like that. She gave a start. She had not heard Rand cross the room. His fingers brushed her cheek, wiping away tears. She was crying. "I'm sorry, Min," he said softly. "I am not a very nice person anymore. A man is dead because of me, and all I can do is worry why he was killed." Flinging arms around him, she buried her face against his chest. She could not stop crying. She could not stop trembling. "I went to Kola Vair's apartments." Images flashed in her head. The empty sitting room, all the servants gone, the bedchamber. She did not want to remember, but now she had begun, she could not stop the words tumbling out. "I thought, since you'd exiled her, maybe there was some way around the viewing I had of her." Kola Vair had been wearing what must have been her finest gown, dark silk that glistened with falls of delicate aged ivory Sovara lace. "I thought for once it didn't have to be that way. You're Taviran. You can change the pattern." Kola Vair had donned a necklace and bracelets of emeralds and fire drops, and rings with pearls and rubies, surely her best pieces. And yellow diamonds had been arranged in her hair, a fair imitation of the crown of Kyrian. Her face. She was in her bedchamber, hanging from one of the bedposts. Bulging eyes and protruding tongue in a blackened, swollen face. Toes a foot above the overturned stool. Sobbing helplessly, Min sagged against him. His arms went around her slowly, gently. "Oh, Min. You have more pain than pleasure from your gift. If I could take your pain, I would, Min. I would." Slowly it penetrated that he was trembling too. Light. He tried so hard to be iron, to be what he thought the dragon reborn must, but it cut him when somebody died because of him. Kola Vair probably no less than fell. He bled for everyone harmed and tried to pretend he did not. "Kiss me," she mumbled. When he did not move, she looked up. He blinked at her uncertainly, eyes now blue, now gray, a morning sky. "I'm not teasing." How often had she teased him, sitting on his lap, kissing him, calling him sheepherder because she dared not say his name for fear he might hear the caress. He put up with it because he thought she was teasing and would stop if she believed it did not affect him. "Ha! Aunt Jan and Aunt Rana said you should not kiss a man unless you intended to marry him, but Aunt Myron seemed to know a little more of the world. She said you should not kiss a man too casually because men fell in love so easily." "I'm cold inside, sheepherder. Kola Vair and Master Fell. I need to feel warm flesh. I need... please." His head lowered so slowly. It was a brother's kiss at first, mild as milk water, soothing, comforting. Then it became something else. Not at all soothing. Jerking upright, he tried to pull away. "Min, I can't. I have no right." Seizing two handfuls of his hair, she pulled his mouth back down, and after a little while he stopped fighting. She was not certain whether her hands began tearing at the laces of his shirt first or his at hers, but of one thing she was absolutely sure. If he even tried to stop now, she was going to fetch one of Rialin's spears, all of them, and stab him. On her way out of the Sun Palace, Cadzwain studied the Aiel Wilders she saw as well as she could without being obvious. Kuriel and Daigyan followed in silence. They knew her well enough by now not to disturb her with chatter, which could not be said of all those who paused a few days at Aralyn's little palace before she sent them on. A great many Wilders, every one staring at the Aes Sedai as if at flea-ridden curs covered with running sores, tracking mud over a new rug. Some people looked at Aes Sedai with awe or adoration, others with fear or hate. But Cadzwain had never seen contempt before, not even from white cloaks. Even so, any people who produced so many Wilders should be sending a river of girls to the tower. That would have to be seen to eventually, and to the pit of doom with custom if need be, but not now. The Althor boy needed to be kept intrigued enough that he allowed her near him, and off balance enough that she could nudge him where she wanted without him realizing. One way or another, anything that might interfere with that must be controlled or suppressed. Nothing could be allowed to influence him or upset him in the wrong way. Nothing. The shiny black coach was waiting in the courtyard behind a patient team of 6 matched greys. A serving man rushed to open the door, painted with a pair of silver stars atop red and green stripes, bowing to the three of them till his bald head was nearly level with his knees. He was in shirt sleeves and breeches. Since coming to the Sun Palace, she had not noticed anyone in livery yet, except a few wearing Dobraine's colors. No doubt the servants were unsure what to wear and afraid to make a mistake. "I may skin Elida when I can lay hands on her," she said as the coach lurched into motion. "That fool child has made my task nearly impossible." And then she laughed so abruptly that Daigyan stared before she could control her eyes. Coriel's smile widened in anticipation. Neither understood, and she did not try to explain. All of her life, the fastest way to interest her in anything had been to tell her it was impossible. But then, over 270 years had passed since she last encountered a task she could not perform. Any day now might be her last, but young Althor would be a fitting end to it all. Chapter 20 Patterns Within Patterns. Contemptuously, Savannah studied her dusty companions, seated in a circle with her in the small clearing. The nearly leafless branches overhead provided a bit of cool shade, and the place where Randall Thor had hurled death lay more than 100 miles to the west, yet the other women's eyes shifted with an air of looking over shoulders. Without sweat tents, none had been able to clean herself properly, no more than a hasty washing of face and hands at day's end. 8 small silver cups, all different, sat by her side on the dead leaves, and a silver pitcher filled with water that had been dented in the retreat. "Either the Karakarn is not following," she said abruptly, "or he has been unable to find us. Either contents me." Some of them actually jumped. Tion's round face paled, and Modara patted her shoulder. Modara would have been pretty if she was not so tall, if she did not always try to mother everyone within reach. Alaris became much too intent on straightening skirts already neatly spread around her, attempting to ignore what she did not want to see. Mera's thin mouth drew down, but who could say whether for the other's open fear of the Karakarn or her own? They had reason to be afraid. 2 full days since the battle and fewer than 20,000 spears had grouped around Savannah. Therava and most of the wise ones who had been to the west were still absent, including all the rest who were tied to her. Some of the missing surely were making their way back to Kinslayer's dagger, but how many would never again see the sun rise? No one remembered such a slaughter, so many dead in so short a time. Even the Algai de Siswai were not truly ready to dance the spears again so soon. Reason to be afraid, yet none for showing it, displaying heart and soul on your face like a wetlander, open and naked for all to see? Riala at least seemed to realize that much. "If we are to do this thing, let us do it," she muttered, stiff with embarrassment. She was one who had jumped. Savannah took the small gray cube from her pouch and placed it atop the brown leaves in the middle of the circle. Somerin put her hands on her knees, leaning over to examine it until she appeared in danger of falling out of her blouse. Her nose nearly touched the cube. Intricate patterns covered every side, and close up you could see smaller patterns within the larger, and still smaller inside those, and a hint of what seemed smaller yet. How they could have been made, the tiniest so fine, so precise, Savannah had no idea. Once she had thought the cube stone, but she was no longer certain. Yesterday she had dropped it accidentally on some rocks without marring one line of the carving, if it was carving. The thing must be a Turangrial, That they knew. The smallest flow possible of fire must be touched lightly there, on what looks like a twisted crescent moon, she told them, and another there on the top, on that mark like a lightning bolt. Somerin straightened very quickly. What will happen then? Alarise asked, combing her hair with her fingers. It seemed an absent-minded gesture, but she always found ways to remind everyone that her hair was black instead of common yellow or red. Savannah smiled. She enjoyed knowing what they did not. I will use it to summon the wetlander who gave it to me. That much you told us already, Riala said in a sour voice, and Tion bluntly asked, how will it summon him? She might fear Randall Thor, but not a great deal else. Certainly not Savannah. Belinda lightly stroked the cube with one bony finger, her sun-bleached eyebrows drawn down. Maintaining a smooth face, Savannah irritably prevented her hands from fingering a necklace or adjusting her shawl. I have told you all you need to know. Considerably more than they needed, in her opinion, but it had been necessary. Otherwise they would all be back with the spears and the other wise ones, eating hard bread and dried meat. Or rather, they would all be on the move eastward, watching for any sign of other survivors, watching for any sign of pursuit. With a late start, they might still cover 50 miles before halting. Words will not skin the boar, much less kill it. If you have decided to creep back to the mountains and spend your lives running and hiding, then go. If not, then do what you must, and I will do my part. Riala's blue eyes stared flat defiance, and Tion's gray. Even Modara looked doubtful. She and Somerin lay the most solidly in her grasp. Savannah waited, outwardly calm, unwilling to tell them again or ask. Inside, her stomach churned with anger. She would not be beaten because these women had pale hearts. If we must, Riala sighed at last. Accepting the absent Therava, she resisted most often, but Savannah had hopes of her. The spine that refused to bend at all was often the most malleable once it gave way. That was as true for women as men. Riala and the others turned their eyes to the cube, some frowning. Savannah saw nothing, of course. In fact, she realized that if they did nothing, they could claim the cube failed to work and she would never know. Abruptly, though, Somerin gasped, and Mera almost whispered, "It draws more. Look," she pointed. "Fire there and there, and earth and air and spirit filling the runnels." "Not all of them," Belinda said. "They could be filled many ways, I think. And there are places where the flows twist around something that is not there." Her forehead furrowed. "It must be drawing the male part as well." Several drew back a little, shifting shawls, brushing skirts as though to rub away dirt. Savannah would have given anything to see, almost anything. How could they be such cowards? How could they let it show?